Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Welcome to Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley on the Blake Radio Network. On each and every show, Doc takes you inside the world of sports to hear from the movers, shakers, and decision makers. Now, I know you thought there were seven wonders of the universe, where here's the eighth, Doc Stanley.
Doc Stanley, Sports in Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports in Depth for the show. And as always, you open up with a prayer led by the legendary John Coltrane's Dear Lord, we thank you for another day. Ask you that you have your will and way. We thank you, Lord, for little things we so largely take for granted. More importantly, dear Lord, we thank you for blessings forthcoming, those that have come and all that have been merited. We thank you, Lord, for being our God. And we ask that you continue to hold us, guide us, strengthen, and lead us. For you're God all by yourself. As that man once said, although we don't live on Park Avenue, by the grace of God, we don't live on a Park Avenue bench. We thank you, Lord, for all things. We ask you blessings, all the blessings. In the name of your darling son, Jesus. Amen. Doc Stanley, Sports Up on the Lake with the Network Rainbow Soul Channel, Sports Up for the show. And I'm looking for Myron Hunter to join me. And we may have a host of other Negro League baseball dinner show. Yesterday, got an email during the course of the week from Myron Hunter, one of the great producers and filmmakers of our time. Everybody knows of Spike Lee. He's a young man that a lot of people should know of, and they have known of. An interesting story came up. You know, Byron said that Babe Ruth's granddaughter approached him about him doing something on the Bay. And I'm having a problem with this board. So, interesting session yesterday. Was very interesting, educational, and there were some things brought up that it was stunning. Jim Robinson was there, a original Negro League player, and also you've heard Jim on our show before, as Jim has become a personal friend of mine, as do the late Jim Plummer, who had the Negro League day at Yankee in a minute, at Shea Stadium. And through the grace of God, through Jim, I got to meet Mr. Robinson, Stanley Glenn, the late Armando Vasquez, the late Pee Wee Jenkins, the late Carl J. Dent, the late Max Manning, Bob Scott, and a host of other Negro League players. And we're looking for Byron. Did you join us yet? Okay, so Byron should be getting in. I got a 646-351-3813. Who's that now? Is that Harold Weston Jr.?
No, that's Skeeter Mitchell, Machine Gun Skeeter Mitchell.
How are you, Doc?
Machine Gun Skeeter Mitchell.
Good to have you, Skeeter. There's Gino Baby Lois. You're interested. I'm looking for Byron to join us. Interesting documentary yesterday. And
oh, yeah. You talk about that.
It was only a few. But really, before we get going, let's Mel Cosell Smith Jr. introduce everybody to the Sports in Depth Nation, and then we'll continue with this segment of Sports in Depth on the Blake Radio Network. Rooney, bring everybody into the nation.
Of course, good doctor. The Sports in Depth Nation is here. The Sports in Depth panel is here. I'm Mel Smith Jr. I'm here. We're here via the Blake Radio Network, and the straw that stirs the drink is here, and that is Doc Stanley. Take it away, Doc.
Thank you, Rudy. And hold on, a young lady has something to say.
All day, all night, all the time. BlakeRadio.com, music for your mind, body, and soul.
And not to be outdone, this lady has something to say.
Check out Rainbow Soul at BlakeRadio.com, where you'll hear talk radio at its best. Featuring entertainment, sports, nutrition, Africana studies, holistic healing, and celebrities. Listen to Rainbow Soul at BlakeRadio.com, where you'll hear talk radio at its best. Rainbow Soul at BlakeRadio.com. Talk radio for your mind, body, and soul.
Welcome Welcome to Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley on the Blake Radio Network. On each and every show, Doc takes you inside the world of sports to hear from the movers, shakers, and decision makers. I know you thought there were seven wonders of the universe, where here's the eighth, Doc Stanley.
It's always amazing when one of the legendary people of radio in our times, Larry Hardesty, gives you that kind of introduction. Larry Hardesty, greatest African sportscast in history of New York City radio in the sense of pure African-American, you know. Hal Jackson was the pioneer, the Jackie Robinson of African-American radio, the guy who entered into every venue of radio, the first DJ, the first sportscaster, the first, I mean, it was Hal Jackson who made Palisades Park what it was, and everybody came through Palisades Park. I mean, everybody, the Rolling Stones, the Temptations, Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, who has Hal as one of his mentors, Linda Ronstadt. Oh, yeah, they all came through. It's a very interesting story. You know, Telly Savalas, who became famous as a Kojak, was the man back in the day when vinyl what was the only thing played on the radio. Well, he was the guy who handled Hal Jackson's record. He was the guy that worked in the record room and handed Hal the music to play on the phonograph, as they called back in that day. And Larry has been the longest running, over a decade and a half or more, LIB, BLS, Inner City Broadcasting as a sports director. Art Russ Jr., probably the Muhammad Ali of radio in a lot of sense, or the Joe Louis. Art was the guy who started sports talk radio. It's really amazing how amnesia is so apropos when white people start talking about the contributions of African Americans. I remember it was sad and touching how Weston would say how ABC Radio had no place for Art Russ Jr. when the new sort of format came in. I remember I spoke to one guy, he said Art couldn't handle the format. Art made the format. Art was the guy who started sports talk radio in this country. And if it's programmed to the world, it was Art Russ Jr. on his radio show who had the number one radio show on ABC, the number one radio show, not the number one sports show, the number one radio show. And yes, that meant he also had the number one radio sports show, Arthur George. You know what I mean? That great line that Rooney always talks about. He would say, yesterday was a problem. No. Yesterday was a canceled check. Tomorrow is a promissory note. Today is all you have. And now I'm coming home. Okay, the only man that Joe DiMaggio would talk to when he had Old Timers Day. That's how I became friends with Joseph Paul DiMaggio, because Art Russ Jr. introduced me to him. It was Art Russ Jr. who told the world years ago that steroids was in baseball. There was a pitcher that brought it in.
A lot of heat about it and caught a lot, a heck of a lot. I remember. And let me just add this about Arthur George, Doc, if I may, was without any fear of contradiction, the best that ever breathed on the phones, okay? No question about it.
Joe DiMaggio was telling Art he'd come up for 15 minutes and stay 2 hours, you know? Okay, first of all, he wouldn't do it for nobody else but Arthur. For 15, Art Russ told me, I remember walking into a room with Art at Mickey Mantle's, you know? And Ali saw him and stood him up. Everybody knew Arthur George, that rapid. Miles Davis would come to his softball games. That's the kind of friendship he had with Miles. Russ Brown, they told me, Arthur, he walked in one day, and to the left was John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and to the right was Miles Davis. Neither know us anymore. The way Walt Frazier told me when I asked him about Russ Brown, he said, Stan, he was on his way down to do a game. He put his tea with lemon and honey down and said, Stan, hey, if you wasn't there, you missed it. You know what I mean? Looking for Byron Hunter to call, and Mr. Jim Robson said he couldn't be with us tonight. So I'm looking at ways that I'm looking at things tonight. They probably all had problems. I'll probably get them together, and we'll do a really special next week where Jim Robson can be with us. He was always Mr. Byron Hunter was always trying to get a hold of Monty Irving to join us tonight. And a couple of the Negro League stars who are still with us, as you know, a host of them have passed on. Young lady had a baseball yesterday. At the first Negro League affair, they tried to do something every year. I remember Delino DeShields, Ozzie Smith were there. I have the pictures with them. And Dave Winfield does something every year out in San Diego, flies in the Negro League players and salutes them. Yeah, and I remember the first affair at Yankee Stadium. The first affair and the only affair at Yankee Stadium. Sonny Height,
one of the most decorated first-grade detectives in the history of New York City Police Department. And he said, Mel, hey, maybe you can help us out. You know, we're trying to put the Negro League thing together, and maybe you can get Art to MC it. And I spoke to Art, got Art to MC it, and Citibank, I think, funded it, brought all the guys out, gave them jackets, little on-the-field thing, and that was it. And we thought, well, maybe they'll do it another year. Never did it again. Jim Plummer took it to new heights. Jim Plummer, the former bat boy for the Mets and became director of community relations. Everybody talked about a tremendous job he did throughout New York City and the country when it came to helping for organizations and donating stuff. And Plummer took it another step further, in fact, two steps further. Not only they were saluted at Shea Stadium, okay, then after the game, no, after being saluted on the field, Plummer took them up. They had their own suite, food, drinks for them and their family, and I'll never forget it. The first time I was there, Jim Plummer had checks for all the players, and they were just profound. They just had, I mean, he had, besides recognition, besides adulation, he had a donation that he could put in their pocket. And I remember talking to Mr. Robinson, and he said when Omar Vinaya, because when Plummer died, Mr. Robinson asked Omar, were they still going to do the Negro League affair? And Omar told him as long as he was there, they would do it. As you know, Omar was no longer there, and no one knew, he said, there's no more Negro League Day in New York City, okay, the mecca of communication in New York City, where the Negro League teams would come in and sell out Yankee Stadium. I mean, Robinson talked yesterday about how in the 40s, the got some background noise. Who's giving it to me? It was the third most lucrative enterprise in the United States. And, of course, when integration came, the Negro League suffered. As Jim Robinson talked about coming in, and when he did, he was catching the downhill side of it. He did play with Hank Aaron. He did play with Ernie Banks. And it wasn't long before they were up in the major leagues, and it was done. Yeah, Buck O'Neill once told me, you know, the man who makes $5 million a year lives with a guy who makes $5 million a year. And a tremendous story, too, was how, I remember Buck O'Neill, I was born right on time. You know, a lot of people said, well, you know, Bucky wasn't born on time. You and Josh and Satchel. And Buck said, no. I remember Buck said, you know, I ate in the best restaurants. I played against the best players. I saw the best performers perform. He said, all I wanted them to do was have the courtesy to ask me if I wanted to play, because I didn't. He said, I played with the best and against the best. And he said, you know, there was no remorse. And Mr. Robinson talked about yesterday about how, you know, the entertainment, and I always said the entertainment and sports are so intertwined. And he said, hey, you know, Nat King Cole and Count Basie, and all those guys were going through the same thing they were going through in the sense of where to eat, where to sleep. He said, that's the first two things the Negro League played had to remember. Where are we going to eat? Where are we going to sleep? And most of the time you slept on the bus and you ate by buying some bologna stuff. But when you got to towns that had a black restaurant, a black hotel, that's where you stayed. And this is what happened with the Great Entertainment. And he talked about, you know, Nat King Cole's car breaking down or missing transportation. So he hopped on the bus with the Negro League team and rode to Kansas City with them. Kansas City was the hub of everything, because they had so many jazz clubs, and everybody loved to go to Kansas City because you could see Dizzy, you could see Parker, you could see Count, you could see Duke, and eventually you could see Miles and Coltrane. And it was just very interesting. And the film was about, it's about actually Babe Ruth and how Babe would barnstorm every year with Negro League teams, Negro League players, and this would put about $1,500 in their pocket, which is an inordinate amount of money in those times. And, you know, Babe was told by the Klan, don't come down here again, basically, we know, with them niggas, you know. And Babe basically said, I'm on my way. You know, Babe came on down. Babe was threatened by the Klan. You know, Babe at one time. Yeah.
I just want to let you know I'm here. This is Byron. I've been on for a while, but I've just been letting you speak, brother. But
okay, ladies and gentlemen, here he is. The man who, well, Byron, because I got your bio late, but I just want you to, the name of the film.
Name of the film is Universal Babe.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it speaks to the universality of the man. When I first came up with the title, people were like, is Babe really a universal figure? And what we chose to do was to actually try to find enough information to let the title, let him live up to the title that we had created, believe it or not. And given, again, not only what he did in the Negro Leagues, but his relationship with, again, Japanese baseball, really his relationship with baseball on a global level, because he was also one of the founding members of baseball in Mexico. He was very involved in the development of baseball in the Caribbean. But, again, other areas such as his involvement in cancer research, his involvement with so many different things, and even the Jews in World War II. So we just wanted to make sure that people understood that Babe was a far more complex creature than he was ever projected to be, and he was far more serious and determined than he was aloof and fun-loving the way they made him. He was a very serious man as well.
Okay, gentlemen. Hold on, Dusty.
Hold on, Dusty.
Before you even get started, because we got 2 hours, so we're going to have you here for the whole 2. Byron, can you just tell everybody how this came about, how Babe Ruth's granddaughter came to you? I spoke earlier. I know Dusty doubted me. But on the serious side, can you tell us how she approached you and how the whole thing came about, Byron?
Well, actually, again, I'll kind of express some of the things that I talked about yesterday, Doc. And I just want to say I feel very blessed to be on your show, and I just appreciate the opportunity always, brother.
This is your platform.
I actually was very fortunate enough to be asked to produce a documentary about Roberto Clemente, another incredible baseball player, many, many years ago. And I actually spent a couple of years working with MLB. I went down and met the family and basically traveled around and really produced a film. I actually had a chance to talk with about a dozen Hall of Famers, and everybody had something to say about Roberto Clemente, although I had never heard some of the things that I heard. So
such as, I mean, we had 2 hours. Talk to us. Such as?
I'm sorry?
Here,
I'll give you a few things. Ken Singleton, the man who does the New York Yankee broadcast,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We were having an informal conversation about Babe, about Roberto Clemente, and he said, Byron, let me tell you something. Nobody knows this, but before I ever became a star in the major leagues, my first year in the league, once I signed, before when I went with Montreal, they sent me to Puerto Rico for the winter leagues to get me ready to come to spring training. My manager was Roberto Clemente. He said the things that Roberto Clemente taught me during that 3 months in Puerto Rico was far greater than what he had learned through most of his minor league career. And he said when he went to the Expos, the reason he became a star so quickly was that he followed a lot of the principles that were taught to him by Roberto Clemente as a manager. I didn't even really know he was a manager, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. to find out how many players that he influenced in that aspect was tremendous. To go further about Roberto Clemente, you can cut me off whenever, Doc.
Keep going.
What a lot of people don't understand is that when Latino players in the 1950s were brought into America, they were recruited by a recruiter who was going through, and one of the big guys was Alex Pompeys, who brought in a number of Cuban players as well as Orlando Cepeda and I think Clemente. But these guys were being brought in from Puerto Rico, where they mostly spoke Spanish their entire lives, and they were basically thrown into these small towns to play minor league baseball. Obviously, it's hard enough for an African-American to go through that, but if you can imagine being black and Latino, so you don't even understand English, but you get to America, and all of a sudden you're a third-class citizen. Because you're not even a second-class citizen, because we were the second-class citizens, and we understood what they were talking about. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So to find out Roberto's story is that he came into minor leagues, and when he got to Pittsburgh to play for the Pirates, he was basically signed and then told, look, you got to find a place on your own. So he had to move to the black community because no white people wanted him to live in that era of Pittsburgh, especially because they didn't know who he was. In latter times, they obviously wanted him, but at that point, he learned that, wow, I'm a black person basically in America. So he ended up becoming very involved in civil rights, even as a Puerto Rican, as he elevated to become a great player. And what I mean by that is that there was an incident about 3 years into his career where the first 2 years when he was there, he was one of only about two or three players of color on the Pirates. So they weren't allowed to stay in the regular hotels and ride on the regular buses and stuff with a lot of the players. So what happened is after the spring training games in Florida, they would basically be given a car and told, here, you all drive yourself to the black part of town and find somewhere to stay. So for the first couple of years, Clemente did that, but as he began to evolve as a superstar player and realized that he had more control over what he could say, he basically went back to the owner of the team and said, look, we're not going to do this anymore. So he came in 1 year to spring training and said, we're not going to ride to the black part of town. You all have to find a solution. And he said this to the owner of the Pirates, and the owner found a solution. So the interesting thing with that about Clemente is that Clemente entertained Martin Luther King when Martin Luther King came to Puerto Rico. Clemente met Malcolm X while he was alive. There are things about Roberto Clemente that we can't even go that far because he was a Puerto Rican civil rights advocate for blacks in the United States. He got into a fight with a black teammate because the black teammate wanted to continue to ride the car to go to the black part of town. And he had a fist fight to force him to say, no, we're going to stand our ground today. So Roberto Clemente in himself is a tremendous icon and figure, probably the second or greatest right fielder, if not the greatest defensive right fielder of all time, but probably the second greatest next to Babe Ruth in terms of right fielder, period.
Defensively, cutting you off real quickly, and gentlemen, hold back on your questions. We're going to get to them. We got 2 hours here. I want Byron to talk as much as he can, as long as he can. So we're going to get in there. But Clemente had no peer.
But just to finish up on Roberto Clemente, let me tell you about people who I spoke to that if you ever run into them, ask them about Roberto Clemente.
Go ahead.
Joe Morgan, the Hall of Famer.
What did he say?
Said that his entire baseball career changed and became a superstar because he learned from Roberto Clemente. Johnny Bench, one of the greatest catchers of all time, said Roberto Clemente was undoubtedly one of the greatest players of all time and has not still been given the credit that he deserves as a baseball player or as a humanitarian. Again, if you go through the litany of Hall of Famers, whether they're black, white, Latino, whatever, they all have just incredible things to say about the spirit and energy of that man and what he meant to baseball. So Roberto Clemente, on that round, he is truly another superstar, and doing his story was a tremendous thing because I began to also understand the great love and compassion that they have for him in Puerto Rico. We took the film down to Puerto Rico and did a 2 or 3 screenings, and they were all jam-packed, and everybody came out in tears and basically really loving the fact that we talked about the humanitarian Roberto Clemente. We talked about the Roberto Clemente that there are over 84 schools are named after him in the United States. That's more than most war generals, more than Babe Ruth or anybody. So that is, you know, Babe Ruth. His influence, or Roberto Clemente, his influence is global, and Babe is very similar.
You talk about Roberto, too, and I know Willie Mays and Roberto played together on that great Santucci team, and everybody, Rosie said hello from Brazil. Hello, Rosie. Roberto played on that great, there was a great minor league team, and if I'm correct, Monty Irvin was Roberto's idol, I believe. Monty, Willie, and Roberto played on that Santucci team with a young phenom shortstop by the name of Don Zimmer and Ruben Gomez, who was an outstanding pitcher.
Yeah, absolutely, who ended up going playing for the Giants as well. Absolutely.
Right, in the major leagues. That was considered probably one of the greatest minor league teams in barnstorming teams ever. 1 year.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that gets missed here, Doc, is that people tend to miss the fact that they look at Latin baseball, and I take nothing away from Latin baseball because Cubans are some of the greatest players of all time, but the influence of African-Americans on Latin baseball once they started going down because they even changed the game there before they changed it here. And that's an important part of our history. One great story that is kind of off the track that people should know is that I had an opportunity to interview Orlando Cepeda about four or 5 years, maybe it's been longer, in Puerto Rico. And we had a tremendous talk about Roberto Clemente and what he meant, et cetera. But one of the things that Orlando had expressed to me is that he said that he was a great young baseball player. Orlando Cepeda's father was a tremendous baseball player.
His father was considered probably the greatest player in Puerto Rican baseball.
Absolutely. So when Orlando came up, he was expected to be exactly like his dad. So he said there was a time when he got about 12 or 13 or 14 when he was noted as the next great player. And for about 2 years, there was so much pressure on him to be the next Orlando Cepeda that he dropped out of baseball altogether. Wouldn't go to the games, didn't participate. His family was worried because they were like, this kid is a great player, but he's just burnt out on baseball. He does not want to play baseball. You want to know what he told me was the influence that got him to go back and play baseball and become the star that he became?
Of course we do.
He said he went to one of the games one day just because he just was bored and decided to go to the game. He went in there, and there was, in the dugout was a young man by the name of Willie Mays. Willie Mays came out and impressed him so much that he realized, you know what, baseball is my calling. He became very good friends with Willie Mays in Puerto Rico now. We're not talking in mistake. This is in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
He said he became the player because Willie Mays re-inspired him to love the game of baseball by the way he played.
You know, it's amazing because Roberto Clemente in 1966, Doc Stanley, Sports Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports Depth for the show, and today it is the Byron Hunter Show. We're trying to keep quiet and listen to this man speak about, first, the legendary Roberto Clemente, number 21, a number that they're trying to also get retired in baseball. 1966, Roberto Clemente became the first Hispanic player to win MVP in the National League. The year before, in 1965, a Cuban, Zorro Fasales, became the first Hispanic ever to win an MVP award in Major League Baseball. In 1967, Orlando Cha-Cha Cepeda won the MVP award, became the first man to ever win the MVP award unanimously. Okay, so the impact of Willie Mays is profound. Listen to me again. In 1967, after being traded from the San Francisco Giants to the St. Louis Cardinals, Orlando Cha-Cha Cepeda became the first man history of baseball to ever win the MVP award unanimously. The year before, the great one, Roberto Clemente Walker, became the first Latin player ever to win the MVP award in the National League. The year before, in 1965, Zorro Fasales, a shortstop who led the league in doubles and triples, American League, was the first Latin player ever to win the MVP award in Major League Baseball. In 1963, Elson Howard became the first black man to ever win the award in the American League. Of course, Jack Roosevelt Robinson in 1949 became the first African-American, black man, Negro, all of the above, to ever win the MVP award. From 1949 to 1969, only four non-minorities won the MVP award. There were 16 winners who were all minorities. And remember, Campanella, 51, 53, 55, became the first African-American to win the award three times. In 1956, Don Newcomb became the first player and African-American to win the Cy Young Award and the MVP, and the first player to win them both in the same year. So just some stats we want to introduce you to. Gentlemen, once again, I'm asking everybody to hold tight. I want Byron to keep rolling. If there's any more Clemente stuff, let us have it, and then we're going to get into Universal Babe. Byron?
All right. Well, again, Clemente, we can go on for all day, a month, and a year, but I think, you know, he, again, exemplifies, and I think there's a great parallel with him and Babe in that they both exemplify these people whose hearts were really bigger for outside of the game and understanding their place in the game and how that represented something on the outside than many others. And it's not to say that there are not other great players or other great people who did great things. But, you know, when you look at Roberto Clemente, to die delivering supplies to Nicaragua is a tremendously valiant thing. And, again, I've come to understand and respect through his family what he meant to not only baseball but to Puerto Rico and to the world. So, again, I think the most fascinating thing was to find out that if you look at Roberto Clemente, again, and this is the true essence of his spirit, is that, as I mentioned, there are over 84 schools, like public schools, yada, 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 named after him. If you take bridges, hospitals, tunnels, and everything that is actually named after Roberto Clemente, there are over 230 structures of some type that are named after this man. There's a baseball field that was built in Germany 30 years ago that's named Roberto Clemente Field that nobody's ever played on, because they don't even play baseball in Germany. They just built it and named it after him, and it just sits there in this little town in Germany. So he, again, had a global effect that it's hard to understand sometimes. And I think a lot of athletes now view themselves as being global. but in real essence are not truly global if you look at the whole world as a as an edifice. So Clemente is someone that we need to always understand and respect, and we also need to just understand that whole legacy of the relationship between African Americans and Latinos in Latin America. Because when I talked to Monty Irvin, you know, when Jim Robinson spoke the other day, when so many people speak about that, it almost sounds like, for lack of a better word, that whole relationship that the Indians had with the African Americans when they sent us on the Trail of Tears. It was like, we're all in this together, so let's just kind of become whatever. But that, I think, changed baseball altogether, and I think that's why you see so many Latinos doing well as African Americans in the game.
Yeah, you talk about Clemente, to cut you off. Carlos Beltran has an academy that he named after Clemente in Puerto Rico, and it's all about scholarships and teaching kids not only about baseball but about life. And you talk about Clemente, there's so much. I know one of his great quotes was that, you know, when you're here on earth and you have a chance to do something to help somebody else and you don't do it, you're just wasting your time here. And if you look at the same quotation by Jackie Robinson, a life is not important except for the impact it has on another life. And then there's Dr. King's great quote, Ali, service to others is rent you pay for your room here on earth. And Dr. King, life's most persistent and most urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Clemente was a guy that was very aware of his fellow man, was very aware of that this life is not forever. And I remember listening to an interview he's having, and a guy asked Roberto something, and Roberto said, well, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be alive then. But then he answered the question. It's amazing that the last hit he got, a double, was his last hit, which gave him 3,000 base hits.
Mm-hmm.
He's the first and only first Hispanic inducted into the Hall of Fame. And ironically, the day before, Clemente had gotten a base hit off Tom Seaver, which should have been a hit. And the official scorer, in some sort of vain figuring that Clemente should have gotten a better hit, called it an error. So for all the reality, Roberto should have had a 3,000 hit the game before, but his last hit, a double, into right center field, was the last hit that Roberto Clemente ever had in baseball, and there was a 3,000 hit. But there's a great saying from the Bible, greater love have no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And if you know Clemente, the copy of the basket catch, with, again, his influence in a relationship with Willie Mays, for my money, the greatest right fielder that ever lived. He was in the Dodger organization. As you know, the quota system didn't allow a certain amount of blacks on a team at a certain time. And he went to Pittsburgh because the Dodgers were doing ridiculous things with Roberto. They were trying to hide him. He would come to the plate to hit, and they would pull him back. They wouldn't put him in the lineup. And the Pittsburgh organization went to the Dodgers and said, look here, we know he's here. We're going to take him, so you might as well play him. And that's how he wound up in Pittsburgh. So we know you can the format is yours. If you want to take a couple of questions real quick about Roberto, if you want to come in, it's a two-hour show. We got you here for the whole 2 hours. We can go longer. Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports and Depth of the show, Byron Hunter. You've heard of Spike Lee. This is his contemporary. this is his equal. This is the name. This is what Sports and Depth is about. It is about enlightening you and bringing you, as what Larry Hardesty, he says, the movers, the shakers, the men who decision makers who change the course of our society. You listen to Byron Hunter, and this is a man who's done so many documentaries. Right now we're talking about Universal Babe. Staggering thought yesterday came up, you know, Babe Ruth, who was helping in the movement, the anti-Nazi movement that was so big. Well, Byron, to get to that. Byron, any more on Roberto?
Well, again, we're going forever for Roberto, but I think the only kind of final things I want to really reflect on him, because I've spoken about the relationship with Puerto Ricans and African Americans and his relationship as a civil rights leader, all those things, but I think you also got to realize that Roberto Clemente is a big-time player. You know, here's a guy who has a hitting streak through the World Series. I don't think he ever did not get a hit in a World Series game. You know what I'm saying? He was up to bat when Bill Mazeroski hit the famous shot around the world, so he might have done that. So, again, as a baseball player, as you mentioned, he's obviously in the top pantheon of the top 5 or 10 players of all time. But I think the fact that he was such a a leader outside of the field escalates him to a much higher level. And I, you know, although I had to fight with baseball over it for months after I did the film, they're listening today. I still believe Roberto Clemente's number should be retired.
Well, you know, in 1960,
I'd like to put you back on one of these.
Okay. Hold on, Dust. In 1960, it was said that Roberto Clemente should have won the MVP award and not Dick Groat. And, you know, people couldn't understand how he was overlooked at. And for a long time, baseball cards were calling him Bob Clemente. And Roberto said, no, my name is Roberto, not Bob Clemente.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was changed. We've got, Justino, go ahead, Dusty.
Yeah, I'd like to piggyback on Roberto Clemente, not to put on any airs, but I knew Roberto very well, and I knew his wife, Zavala, when the kids were babies. Roberto Jr., when he was sort of pressurized to be another Roberto Sr. But I go a little further. That perhaps some of you may not know the fact that when I was in the fire department, I was a lieutenant. I was the president of the Hispanic Society Fire Department. And when he won the World Series, was MVP, he was the first Puerto Rican that we fought for, and we got him an honorary deputy fire chief title. The city fought against it. Of course, we put in a lot of pressure. We got pressure to give him the honorary fire chief. And I have pictures of the whole situation.
Dusty, you said that the city fought against it, Dusty?
Yeah, the fire department fought against it. We put enough pressure with Badillo and all them guys to have him recognized as why, because of his humanitarian work. And at the same time, I hesitate to say the word stuck, but I did get stuck with organizing with his help and his committee people, Roberto Clemente Little League in the Bronx during the riots and the Bronx is burning. But we had to highlight the fact that the firefighters were community minded as well as others. So I organized the fire department Roberto Clemente League with his help, and that was years ago. And many people don't remember that he was an honorary New York City deputy fire chief, and that the tragedy here from the elation of him getting that, you know, the pictures that we, you know, he had his helmet and everything. He said, "Look, yo soy un bombero ahora," you know. So, and because he still didn't know English, I did the translation, and that same winter was when he died.
That December,
and, it was a tremendous loss. After, you know, we got that, but no, he wasn't. I found to be that I could talk to him like if he was a long lost friend that I knew for 20 freaking years, man. You know, and we sat down. We used to talk a lot about baseball, my career in the fire service, and his career when he started. And ironically enough, my mom came from his time of Carolina, Puerto Rico. Now they call it Calle Clemente, and so we had this symmetry, this connection of long time, you know, people who came from his own bury. But what I was trying to say that, yes, I'm glad you talked about him because to me he was a very good, I'm glad, I'm honored that I got to meet him and sit down and speak to him. I got I got to see the kids, get to know the family, his mother, all of these folks, you know, because of my involvement in community work, and he was all too willing to help us. And that year, like I said, he was, he lost his life. I was in New York at the time when that happened. My sisters were in Puerto Rico, and they went over where the plane fell, and they stood vigil for, a day or two, hoping that the plane would be resurrected and his body, he would be found. I mean, found alive, at least his body. But somebody correct me, or you guys correct me. I don't think his body was ever found.
I don't believe it was either.
His body was never found, and it does become like a chapel there. You know, it's become like a sacred ground, so to speak, where the great Roberto went down. Yeah,
Roberto Walker. You know, you talk about Roberto. Willie Stargell. Willie Stargell. When Mr. Stargell and we talked about Clemente, he said, "You know, Roberto taught me how to win." September 1st, 1971, you take your hat off to Dernie Murtaugh. That's the first time in history of Major League Baseball. Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake with an Eric Rainbow. So the channel Sports and Depth for the show. It ain't Spike Lee, baby. It's the man better, Byron Hunter. September 1st, September 1st, 1971, or maybe September. Let me double check the date for you. I got it here. But the first time ever you had an all-black lineup, and on the field, Willie Stargell was at first base. Second base was Norm Cash. Shortstop, Jackie Hernandez. Third base, Minnie Stinnett. And left field, Al Oliver in center field. Gene Kleins in right field. On the mound was Doc Ellis. Behind the plate was Manny Sanguin. And in right field, the great one, Roberto Clemente Walker. The first time in the history of baseball you had an all-black lineup and an all-black team on the baseball field. Roberto was there. Danny Murtaugh was the manager. I believe that, I know it was September 1st or September 9th. I'll get the exact date for you. 1971. That's when it happened. And Roberto was there. And Roberto also, as you know, became the first Hispanic to win the World Series MVP award when the Pirates beat the favorite Baltimore Orioles. Doc Danny, Sports Net, Byron Hunter, Universal Babe, and evidently Universal Roberto. The questions... we can ask them. We've got a two-hour show. It will be all Byron. He'll be talking. He'll be talking about Roberto. We're talking about Babe. We'll be asking him questions. Dustin,
yeah, I have a question
else?
On Babe Ruth. Yeah, I have a question. First, Al Oliver was in left field, but I'm still going out of my mind trying to remember that thin Panamanian who played left field when the Pirates with Willie Stargell won the World Series in that winter game. I never forget that slide he made when he caught that ball in the air and it slid all the way through a snowbank. Some thin Panamanian playing left field. And I don't remember his freaking name. It's driving me up a wall, man. But anyway, I leave you guys. You pundits of sport, remember that one. But a question about Babe Ruth. It's remarkable that you said what you said about Babe Ruth. Because in all of his bio, in all of his movies played by William Bendix, and all them other people, this hidden treasure of Babe Ruth was never brought out, as far as I'm concerned. Forgive my ignorance if it was, but I never knew this. I never knew how he integrated with. I never knew how he developed such camaraderie with all other nationalities, and I never knew that he was even threatened by the KKK and all that nonsense, because they never published that in his movies or newspapers or readings or anything. Where do you go? What archives you have to dig up behind 10 tons of earth to find this out? I mean, you guys must have done a tremendous amount of research to find this out, because
it's that same old story that we constantly talk about. And when it comes to history, depending on who's saying it, it's his story as opposed to history. And Byron has given us history as opposed to we've so long been hearing his story. And you're right. Burb has always been this buffoon, this drinker, this woman chaser, this cigar smoking.
And he would go up there, stand before the mound, I mean, not before the home plate, and point, and have to having six wrangles, and all that. Big home run, man. You know, so that's all we knew about him.
Go ahead.
Skeeter Mitchell here. I'd like to ask a question. The other day, I was talking in the barbershop with some fellas, and this old timer, he played with the Clowns of the old Negro League.
The Indianapolis Clowns, right.
And I asked him, I said, Roberto Clemente, because naturally, whenever you speak of right field, Roberto Clemente got to be in there. I said, you know, Roberto Clemente, we made such strides in baseball. I said, had he have lived, could you see him as a manager? And you know what this old guy said? He rubbed his chin, and one of the greatest compliments I ever heard given to Roberto Clemente, he said, manager hell, I could see Roberto Clemente as a commissioner of baseball.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Profound.
Wow. I thought that was so great, man. You know,
profound.
Yeah.
Wow.
Heavy duty. Yeah.
Wow.
That's how much he was revered and awed, because the man was a true athlete. Of course, I loved him. I got to meet him personally, and I still have this joy of of saying, geez, I knew the man.
Yeah,
and I knew
his
family.
Don't keep talking about you met him. I never. Don't keep saying that, else you're going to have problems, okay? Don't keep saying you met him.
We're going to have problems. Do we have to slap each other now over the radio?
Well, you know what? I'm on my way over. I'm on my way over right now. You know, just a great player. And I remember he won an All-Star game, and Willie Mays scored the winning run. And all the press came to Willie, and Willie said, "Hey, the man who won the game is right over there." And one of the greatest pitchers I've ever seen is, and I think the greatest National League outfield of all times, okay, is the pitcher. It is Hank Aaron, who's left field, Willie Mays in center field, and Clemente is in right field. All three of those guys have 3,000 base hits. All those guys are Hall of Fame as first ballot players. I don't think there's a better outfield any place, anywhere, anytime. We lost Rooney. I tried to get a hold of him back.
Let me segue into that.
Go ahead.
Wasn't there rumblings and complaints when Roberto was inducted into the Hall of Fame because he didn't have the numbers and something to that effect? Maybe
The same way Garrick went in. You know, Garrick was got in before because he died, so it was before the 5-year thing. And you know, I am positive that there must have been some grumbling because, two of the things that Roberto Clemente was most proud of was being Hispanic and black. I remember at one of the boxing affairs, one guy was telling me that, you know, when Roberto came to America, he couldn't believe how bad African Americans were treated because they were black. Is there any truth to that, Byron?
Yeah, that's very true. And again, the thing with Roberto that people don't realize is that in Pittsburgh, he was a civil rights leader, even though he was not even African American. When we went to Pittsburgh to shoot the film, we were in Pittsburgh for 4 or 5 days, and we ran across, you know, we figured we'd try to get a cross-section of people, and one of my interviewers went and pulled a man aside just randomly off the street. African-American gentleman, probably in his 50s, and we came to him and said, you know, sir, we're doing a documentary, and we would just like to ask you, what do you think of Roberto Clemente? And the first thing he did is he stopped me, and he said, stop. The first thing you need to know is that here in Pittsburgh, especially in the black community, we don't call him Roberto Clemente. We would prefer that you address him as the great one.
Oh, wow.
I said, okay, I got you. And he said, let me tell you a story. It almost sounds like it came out of a movie. Bunch of black kids in Pittsburgh, got nothing to do. We out on the field messing around, yada, yada. This white Cadillac pulls up. This immaculately dressed guy gets out of the car, beaming with this joy and confidence, sits down, doesn't even speak good English, but spends half an hour playing baseball with us, teaching us how to hit the bat and how to throw the ball and how to catch it. And he's like, and then he would leave. And he's like, that's what Roberto represented to the black community. When there were issues regarding certain things where black people's rights were violated, Roberto Clemente was there. When there were other black leaders who weren't even there, complaining in his broken English about stuff. And so they said at first people kind of joked about it, like, who is this Puerto Rican and why is he coming in with this broken English fighting for us? But again, I go back to the beginning of this statement where I said the man told me in the black community in Pittsburgh, we do not call him Clemente. We call him the great one. And I think that speaks for itself.
That's fantastic.
Amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing.
You know, me and some people were talking, and the question was, what was the saddest day in baseball history? And it was about 7 of us. And 6 of us said the day that Roberto Clemente died.
Wow.
One guy said the day Thurman Munson died, which was a sad day. But when Roberto Clemente died, I mean, it was such a profound, sorrowful effect, not only on the game, but on the world. Because this man was a true humanitarian.
Rooney, what's up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was a true humanitarian, giving to others. And he was warned. He was told not to get, because the plane was overloaded. He was told not to go. But he had gotten into some political problems with the fact that he didn't feel or he didn't trust the delivery of those goods to those folks. And it wasn't going directly to the people who were needy. And that's one of the reasons why he says, I'm going to board this plane, and I'm going to make sure that whoever is waiting, and this is intended for, gets to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that gut suspicion because the rumblings were coming back and it wasn't delivered to the correct folks. That's
yeah, yeah, the right people weren't getting it. Yeah. Or they weren't yeah. they weren't getting the, what they were supposed to be getting.
Right, well, right.
The statistic that I learned from the family, from my understanding, is that actually it wasn't even rumblings. What happened was he was sending flights over, and what was happening is that after the earthquake in Nicaragua, because of the devastation there, they declared a state of emergency. So they had the military on the street. So in the airports, when the planes were landing, the military was taking the food off of the planes. And they were like, we know this ain't going. So one of the guys who had taken an early shipment over came back to Puerto Rico and said, Roberto, every time we take a shipment over, the military's taking this stuff off. And we don't think it's going where it needs to go.
To the people.
That's when Roberto said, I'm going
to
go tomorrow. The problem was that at that time, because he was already had rented other planes, the plane that he rented to go that time was not even prepared to take off. He should never have gotten on it. But I think that, and I can't speak for the family or anybody else, I can only speak for what I've been told, but my understanding was that there are people in the family that believe that Roberto knew that plane was going to crash. He knew it wasn't in the best shape, but he followed his destiny. And so that's all part of just the madness of what? Because as you, like you had mentioned before, sir, Roberto Clemente talked about not living for many, many years. He had always talked about him not being a long time.
Yeah, he did.
Roberto Jr. had told me that he and his father had always talked like that. So, and he, in the night that apparently that he left to get on the plane, apparently Roberto Jr. flipped out and was crying and grabbed his dad and said, please don't go, because he felt something.
Yeah, you know, it's an amazing story you tell about, and I've gotten to know Roberto Clemente Jr. quite well, a remarkable young man, always called me Doc. And he told a tremendous story about Roberto Clemente Jr. Had a girlfriend in junior high school, and came to school the next day, and she was gone. She was gone, and, you know, week went by, just gone, just up and gone, up and gone. And now we switch forward, and Roberto Clemente is a sportscaster on Latin Radio Yankee Stadium. And fly ball to right field, Winfield's got it, and the inning's over. And at the end of three innings, the Yankees 3 and the Red Sox 1. And we'll be back after this word from my sponsor. Well, they pan the camera through the stands, and Roberto's looking, and he says, ho, take the camera, Go back. Hold on. What section is that young lady sitting in? She looks familiar. Goes down. It's his girlfriend from back in junior high school.
Wow.
Hadn't seen her for decades. What had happened, the way I'm told the story, she had a family member who got killed or something, so they had to put the family in the witness protection program. And they just moved them out of Puerto Rico. And here it is years later. Roberto met up with her, and I heard they got married. Just a remarkable story.
What a human interest story.
About Roberto Clemente Jr. Mel Smith Jr., we lost him. I guess he'll be coming back. We'll try to get him back. It's Doc Stanley, Sports Network on the Blake Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports Network Show. We've got Byron Hunter with us. We're talking about Universal Babe. At the same time, start talking about Universal Roberto. We'll be back in just a minute. Excuse me, a little cough there, as we're going to do our
take your lozenges.
And no, I'd rather take the tea with honey and a shot of brandy every single time. Who needs
Luton
Cross?
I have lead liver that right away.
Hey, make sure he's walking Roscoe. We'll be back. It's a half minute break. Byron Hunter, baby, he's here with the stories. And as I told you, you've heard of Spike Lee. Will meet his contemporary and superior. We'll be right back in just a minute. Doc Stanley, Sports Network on the Blake Radio Network. Byron Hunter, Extraordinaire, is right here.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Welcome to Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley on the Blake Radio Network. On each and every show, Doc takes you inside the world of sports to hear from the movers, shakers, and decision makers. I know you thought there were seven wonders of the universe, where here's the eighth, Doc Stanley.
Quickly, you know, we always want to say hi to our number one listener, Rosie. Come, Rosie, we're doing well. Everybody says hello to you. It's amazing. Yeah, I'm feeling a little better. She is our number one listener from Volta, Redonda, in Brazil, right outside of, Mel Smith has finally come back with us, right outside of from Rio de Janeiro. As you know, 2014 will be the World Cup Games, and in 2016, the first Latin country ever to host the Olympics. Now, Rosie is saying September 1st. Rosie, thanks a lot. You're right. September 1st, 1971, the first time in African American and American baseball history that all black lineup. Once again, Willie Stargell is the first base, oldest man ever to win the MVP, and the only man to be co winner of the MVP, as he won MVP that year with Keith Hernandez. Second base, Dave Cash. Shortstop, Jack Hernandez. Third base, Rennie Stennett. Left field was Gene Kleins, who was a coach with the great Dusty Baker, San Francisco Giants team. In center field, Al Oliver, behind the plate, Manny Sagan, a World Series champion winner with Oakland A's, and Doc Ellis, who threw a no-hitter and became a Yankee too. And right field, the great one. There's a statue in Pittsburgh, simply says that, the great one, when you talk about Roberto Clemente Walker, the only number 21, as far as I'm concerned. Rooney, you dashed out on this. You must have a question or two to ask Mr. Hunter about Roberto Clemente.
Yeah, I do, Doc, and thanks again. Again, please pardon, I've been having a bit of technical difficulties lately with this network, as you know, but I won't go into that.
Okay.
My question is, thanks, Doc, my question is, and thanks for being on the show, this is Mel Smith Jr. I wanted to know, what was it that got Roberto involved in his philanthropy in regard to the, you know, the food drive and you know, the giving that, ultimately, you know, took his life, if you will. But what was it that had, you know, his insatiable appetite to give back?
I think it would be hard for anybody to really understand the depth of that. But I think if you look at Roberto, I think it starts with his parents. Obviously, he was a mama's boy. And he was tremendously obsessed with his mother, who was a very similar type person. But I would also say that one of the most dramatic things that I learned, and again, I can't speak for the family or anyone, but most dramatic things I learned from talking with the family, it was the whole situation when he moved to Pittsburgh. Because, again, you have to understand that he was a kid. He was growing. He had been raised in a very nice spiritual family. He had everything he needed. He had not experienced racism in Puerto Rico. He had not ever had to even fend for himself. So, again, to get to Pittsburgh as a young man and be told, you got to find a place to live, but you can't live amongst the white folks. So you got to move to the black part of town.
Wow.
He ended up befriending a gentleman who lived there. And it's going to kill me that I don't have his name in front of me right now. But he was an African-American, a retired Army veteran, who took Roberto under his wing and basically was the person who really guided Roberto through his relationship with the African-American community. He took him to the baseball games every day for the first couple of years of his life. His first couple of years he was in Pittsburgh, and he basically was his friend every single day. And again, before the show is over, I'm going to remember or get this guy's name because he's a very similar figure who nobody ever talks about. That was in Roberto Clemente's life. But he is the one that directed him to understanding, like, this is what it means to be black in America, Roberto. This is what we deal with, and this is what racism is, and these are the haves and have-nots. And I think that had a tremendous impact on Roberto, especially when he became a superstar. The first few years, he really tried to lay back in the cut, but once he became the person that he knew had a voice that could affect people, he used it to his greatest extent, and I think that was really cool.
Great explanation, Brad. So what you're basically saying is that basically he had this awareness at a very young age.
Yes. Yes, and I think you have that really with a lot of people. I think that if you look at Babe Ruth, and we're not going to completely jump over to Babe right now, but you have to look at Babe Ruth's situation. You know, again, he and Roberta were cut from the same cloth in terms of the giving and the excessive stuff they did, especially in the community. And Babe Ruth was a person who grew up with his parents, and his parents actually put him in an orphanage. He wasn't an orphan.
Yeah.
He knew who his parents were. They lived with him. He was just such a bad kid that they could not take care of him, so they put him in. So again,
it was
the psychology or the mentality of Babe Ruth to know that I have parents who love me, but they don't even want to deal with me, and they have put me in this situation. So it's really ironic that he came out the way he did, giving millions and millions of dollars to kids and doing all what he did. So
let me ask you this, Baron, if I may. I know you're trying to get in, Dusty. I'll try to be brief.
Perfectly all right.
Well, thanks, Dusty. Well, why is it then that we have this picture, this almost, I don't know, I'm not going to say comic book character, but this character of the Babe, of this wild and woolly, just devil may care, not too introspective, just for the day type of guy.
You want to know honestly why I think it's that way? I think it's the way that the media and the world can always control Babe Ruth. I think it's a way, because think about it, one of the most sacred institutions in this country is Major League Baseball. If you want to find, and again, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but if you want to find the most arrogant people and people who are most entitled and believe they know it all, you need to look up the Baseball Writers Association of America. This is an association that I don't think there are even any blacks to this day, and if there are, they're probably only one or two. And you talk about society.
Byron, to dovetail that, I don't know if there are. Maybe I have to see if George Willis is.
I think my dude who writes for ESPN, I think he might be a member now. The other brother
You're talking about now. But when you're talking about baseball is the fiber of the mindset of this country. And to know baseball is to know that you're talking blatant, overt racism. Bill White, who became the first sportscaster of African American to get into the booth, also became the first highest position ever for an executive for an African American. He became president of the National League. And I know Bill. I remember Bill when Bill resigned, and I asked Bill why he resigned, and I see Bill White's face right now, and Bill told me because they're not going to change. Okay? The mindset. Is that you, Mike? What's the background there? The mindset of white America is not going to change. Okay? And therefore, the racist concept. It's amazing that Babe Ruth is still seen. And you're the first one to ever bring this out, Byron, in a very controlled nature and a very white nature. I mean, because people always tell you that they consider Babe Ruth the greatest player ever played because he was a great pitcher and he was a great hitter. But they never tell you about the great humanitarian. And I knew Babe was a guy that had no problem with color. In the book, Only the Ball Was White, is believed that Babe was a brother getting over. And it always hit me, you know, why would parents put their kid in an orphanage? I mean, would you put your kid in office?
Exactly.
My mindset here is that somewhere along the line, somebody may not think this kid is all that.
Well, it was a different mindset.
That's the impression when you place a kid in an orphanage. He's a discard. I mean, just like you take the kids who constantly delinquency and running away to put them in Spofford here in Brooklyn. I mean, and all these, because they are bad kids. But, I mean,
this was your own kid, though. This was your own kid.
Well,
this
is what I'm saying. I'm just going to say it's a failure of the parents not to be able to reach that child. There was something missing with those people, to put them in an orphanage with other kids who really didn't have any parents. And yet the kid, instead of becoming a delinquent, he turned out to be a good humanitarian.
Well, The only thing here was how do you put, a lot of times you put a kid away and it's the mother's kid or the father's kid. But this was their kid. How do you put your kid?
Right.
This is the point I'm talking about.
But, But I think it falls into some, I think it falls into something that I think we see now, and I think we need to think about this for a second, because again, you have to see Babe Ruth, delinquent kid that made good. That is what America is. The media always wants to sell. Just like whenever you see an African American athlete. If the best story is he grew up in the ghetto, he had no parents, he lived in the street, he had to eat out of trash cans. They don't want to hear about the African American whose father went to Harvard, yada yada, and he's an NFL football player.
Here's a better story, Byron.
It's always about the poor kid that came up and made it. And I think they want to always keep Babe Ruth as this poor kid that made it out of the whatever to be whatever. But they don't want to recognize, because they've done, and since 2000, in the last 10 years, there have been 6 major documentaries done on Babe Ruth. Sports Century did one, HBO did one, Arts and Entertainment did one. There are a number of networks that did them. I watched all HBO of them. None of them even talk about him having friends. How can Babe Ruth be, you do a one-hour documentary, and Babe Ruth ain't home, you can't say he had friends. But it would have involved them having to go deeper and find out who were his friends. And then they would have to realize, oh, his best friend really in life was Bill Bojangles Robinson. His second best friend in life was probably Joe Louis or Pop Lloyd, the baseball player in Atlantic City. So when you start to break it down and realize that we can't tell a story about the friends and the associations Babe had without bringing black people into the story,
then
it becomes down to the baseball writers wanting to let you know that.
I mean, and you look at, I mean, Bill Vergonen, and I've told this story. Dr. Donnie Sports and Depth on the Blake Vitter Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports and Depth of the show. It's Universal Babe and Universal Clemente and the real Spike Lee, Byron Hunter, Spike Lee's the real Byron Hunter. I remember Bill Vergonen did a great story on Muhammad Ali. I'll never forget it, because I came into the press room and I said, Bill, that was a great piece on Ali. And the story ended, I'll never forget the story, is Ali has made millions with some of have not made one. He's been a champion 3 times, and some have never been champion once. And I said, Bill, that was a great story on Ali. And Bill said, Mel, I wasn't Doc Stanley just yet. He said, Mel, it took me 2 years to get that story in. He said, when they found out it wasn't your typical poor, broke, down on his luck black fighter story, they didn't want it. I said, ho. I said, this is Muhammad Ali. He said, Mel, it took me 2 years to get this story in about how well Muhammad Ali is doing. And as often as things change, they remain the same. They'll tell
let me
story.
Say this, Doc, for the uninitiated, not to cut you off, but your fans should know this. You know, off the air, we've had this discussion, and you told me this story about how hard it was for him to get that Ali story on and how it did take a number of years before they would accept the story, for the very reason that you're mentioning, because it wasn't your typical broke down fighter suffering from
punch drunk syndrome.
Yes, from dementia. Now he does have, pardon me, Parkinson's. You know, of course, but you know, I have, you know, and Doc, you know this as well. I've spoken to people who've been around Ali, and they say, of course, is you know, motor skills as far as speaking and what have you have been affected. But they say that he's still, you know, relatively free. And as you know, on his side, he's kind of like an amateur magician. He loves kind of to perform and, you know, kind of leave the crowd in stitches, if you will. Ali will always be Ali.
Yeah. Byron is saying something. Byron, you spoke yesterday, Byron, about that period after the Civil War, where we had the highest populace of African-Americans, Negroes, colored Negroes, ex-laid, hi, Rosie, in public office because Confederates couldn't run, Brian.
Absolutely. And we had more political power, and we owned more land in 1897 than we do now, brother.
There we go. We were educated. You know,
Hold on. Everybody say goodnight to Rosie. She's got to go. Everybody say goodnight, Rosie.
Good night, Rosie.
We love you, girl. See you next week.
Yeah. But what I was going to jump into here, it was the fact that, first of all, it was almost impossible, and please correct me if I'm wrong, to look at Muhammad Ali or even his brother, Rudolph Valentino Clay, And poor downtrodden ragamuffins, where the mother was an educated person, so was the father. They were middle class. They were actually middle class.
And
when he first turned pro after the Olympics, it was those 10 millionaires who took over his contract. And correct me if I'm wrong again, because I'm going by memory, and, you know, my memory is a little slippy, but his first paycheck from his first pro fight was $50,000, man. And,
he made that
He made that much money in the first place because they took his money. He didn't have to work. They got him Angelo Dundee, and all he had to do was train, and they took his money.
We understand that from the early part of his career.
Let me finish. This is why he's now sitting on a trust fund that's worth over $300,000 for the rest of his life, because they invested his money. Whatever happened to the other money,
that's a different story. That money was lost.
What I find really amazing is
they were known as the Louisville Syndicate, and one of the main members of that Louisville Syndicate was a Mr. Reynolds, who was the one who was the president of Reynolds Wrap, Why is it these guys would take advantage of this kid? All the money he makes, would they do that?
Are you talking about Muhammad?
Muhammad Ali, yeah. You know,
my question is, you guys ever see the documentary that was on ESPN today? They had it was on ESPN Classics, and they had the African American fighter's journey to greatness.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
How are you guys? Oh, I thought you guys knew I was there. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mike.
Joining in a little late. The thing that I really found most intriguing about Muhammad Ali, I learned some stuff about some fighters that traveled from England. It's an amazing journey. The thing that I always sticks in my mind about Muhammad Ali, this is coming from Vinny Pazienza the other night. Vinny Pazienza gave more respect the other night in his statement to Muhammad Ali than to Rocky Marciano's statue being unveiled this weekend. The thing that Muhammad Ali that was so special, it's amazing. I found that coming from an Italian-American, I thought it extremely amazing that Vinny, and Vinny's a true cat. You know, Aaron Davis from the Bronx will be the first to tell you he always respected Vinny. But going back to Muhammad, the thing that I found special about Muhammad, there was always a statement. You know, Muhammad Ali chose to be a fighter. And if Muhammad was not a boxer, they say that he would have been the best lawyer, he would have been the best politician, he would have been the best doctor if Muhammad decided to do that.
And to go to education.
A lot of people don't know Muhammad Ali made an album back in the day called I Am the Greatest, and it's generally acknowledged now as one of the first rap records, you know, because of the rhythm and rhyme of it, you know.
And he cut a nice Stand By Me. I've got that on the album. Gentlemen, what we want to do, we want to slide back to Byron and get back into we talked about Universal Babe. Byron, we'll continue with you. You talked about Babe. You spoke about the yearly tours he did with the Negro Leagues and how the Ku Klux Klan had told him, don't come down here with them niggas again.
Well, I think it goes back again. I think that goes back to the times, and we really have to, again, I hate to keep pulling it back to that, but when I make documentaries, and I was very fortunate to learn from Tim Reed and obviously Arthur Rash and others, but what I've always learned is understand the historical context of the time. And you have to understand, Babe Ruth won the World Series in 1918 with the Boston Red Sox, and was at that point the most popular player in the world, or getting ready to pass that call as the most popular player in the world. And at that time, we had just finished the World War One. Americans were coming back from war, and African Americans came back and said, well, look, we fought in World War One. So, you know, what's up with us, and where do we get ours, and when do we get jobs? And the American backlash to that was to go into about 40 cities and destroy all the black towns and kill a whole lot of people. They called them race riots, but I never really surmounted to calling something a riot when one group comes in and kills the other. But that's our own debate, okay? But my point is that while we're going through one of the most turbulent racial periods ever, because between 1918 and 1921, that was when Black Wall Street was burned down in Tulsa. That was when a number of black communities were decimated. Babe Ruth was barnstorming, so it's not just that he was just doing this. It was like, this was a time when you weren't even, as a white person, supposed to be seen around black people. And this dude was traveling as a player on an all-black team against another team of black people. So when you look at it in the context of what was happening from 1918 to 1921 in America, it's far more amazing that the Klan and all these people, because they were like, this is the height of our time right now. This is the height of the Ku Klux Klan. So, you know, they weren't a small majority either. So Babe, for him to say, I'm going to go and barstorm with these black people anyway, is just a testament to something that has never really been told about Babe Ruth. That's stronger than anything I've ever heard written about Babe Ruth.
This is very strong when I'm here, and I can't even believe sitting back here listening to this right now. It's first I've ever heard.
I'd like to ask a question. You know, I heard that Babe Ruth had a voracious appetite for hot dogs. Now, is that true, or is that just another Babe Ruth myth?
Absolutely, he did. And that's one of the things that, again, in understanding from the family the story of Babe Ruth, the one thing I think it's important to keep in mind, and we try to add this in the film as often as possible as well, is that we're not going to canonize Babe either. You know, he wasn't a saint. Babe ate hot dogs and ordered beer and ordered hot dogs in while he was playing in the game. There were games that he ate two or three hot dogs during the game. He had the Bat Boys bring him hot dogs during the game. So, yes, was he ever raised an appetite for women? He did. Did he ever raise an appetite to go into clubs and be the like they said, Babe Ruth was wanted in every speakeasy in New York?
Hey, Byron, with all due respect, Byron, let me say this quickly, okay? If a guy can hit home runs like that, okay, you know, whatever he does to excess, you know, it's his business, but if you can take a knock the ball out of the park like that, then, you know, more power to you, all right? whatever suits your fancy, all right?
Absolutely. But the thing is that, once again, we have to look at the greatness of Babe, because he did things that other people didn't do in terms of how he sacrificed but yet still delivered. So just like Roberto Clemente, he was a big-time guy. I got to tell you an interesting story. He went to a boarding school called St. Mary's, which was in Baltimore. He went down with the Yankees because the Yankees were going to play the Baltimore Orioles at that time. It might have been Baltimore, probably the Baltimore Braves or whatever. So he went down to play this game against the Baltimore Braves. But the morning of the game, because the game was a later game, I think the game was at 3 o'clock that day. The morning of the game, he went to St. Mary's, which was the orphanage or the school that he had grown up in. He went down there. He met the kids. The kids saw him. He did an exhibition where he hit home runs in the stadium that the kids were playing in for an hour and a half. The officials from the Yankees did not find him in the clubhouse. They went to the school. They grabbed him and said, dude, we got a game at the stadium. They grabbed him, said, no more exhibition stuff. You shouldn't have even done that. They grabbed him, took him to the game to play, and I think either Grogan Alexander or one of the great pitchers, I can't think of the other one, was pitching. Babe Ruth hit 3 home runs that day.
For the uninitiated, Doc, I know the reporters on this panel know this, but for the uninitiated, our fans listening, you know, Byron, I talk about how, and we, you know, happen to know this, that at the time Babe was doing this, he was hitting more home runs singularly than entire ball clubs were collectively.
I want to give you two stats that you will never hear again in professional sports or baseball, I'm sure. Babe Ruth, over the course of his career, in one particular season, I can't remember if it was 1921 or 23, in one season, he hit more home runs than 19 teams. Listen to me, 19 teams. He hit more home runs than 19 teams. Over the course of his career, he outbatted teams 90 times. That means in his career, he hit more home runs than 90 teams over the course of 15 years.
No, people can't comprehend
then we'll never be able to comprehend that in itself. And that's the one thing I'm saying. When you're saying, you know, what would it take to hit more home runs in one team this year? You'd have to hit about 200 or 190 to beat the worst team in the league.
Yeah, the number of home runs that Babe, I mean, it was unheard of. Babe was the first guy to hit 30 home runs in the 1 year, the first guy to hit 50, the first guy. I mean, you know, Babe, like you said, Babe was hitting.
Babe, let me correct you, Doc. Babe was the first person to hit 30, 40, 30, 50, and 60.
Right, okay. Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. You're right.
All
I mean,
of them. You're right. No, you got it, brother.
In fact,
he set the standard. At one point in one season, he hit home run. I don't remember, again, forgive me for not knowing the years because I just finished this film and I got all the years in my head, but one season, Babe Ruth hit, I think he hit 50 home runs or 48 home runs, and the next closest person was like 22.
Yeah, Babe Ruth was hitting more home runs than, when Babe Ruth started hitting home runs in the first part of his career, he was hitting more home runs than the whole teams were putting by himself. I mean, you got to understand, Home Run Baker was called Home Run Baker, and the most home runs Home Run Baker ever hit in 1 year was 4.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. Home Run Baker, you know, in Babe Ruth's day, and this is why Cobb was such an anti-Ruth guy, because in Babe Ruth's day, Dusty hit a single, Byron hit a single, Doc hit a single, the bases were loaded. Okay? And this is where Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays changed the game, too, because nobody went from first to third on a single. You just went to the next base. In the old days, okay, we'd go for 2 runs, win the game 2-1. Here comes Babe Ruth, 3-run home run. That's out the window. And people talk about Dick Williams.
Was the bane of John McGraw. John McGraw was considered the greatest manager of that era. And the reason that John McGraw won all those championships, because remember, the New York Yankees weren't anything until Babe Ruth came. The New York Giants and the other New York teams were, but the Yankees weren't anything
that
before.
Byron, the Giants, when Babe Ruth came, who started the crowds coming, that's why the Giants kicked the Yankees out of the polo grounds, because of Babe.
Exactly. So people had this whole thing like the Yankees been. No, the Yankees weren't anything until 1921. They were nothing before that. John McGraw was the greatest manager of the era from 1890s to 1900s, right? He's the master of scoring that 1 run, scoring them 2 runs, scoring that 3 runs. He was the bane of Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was the bane of his existence. Because like
that,
you said, Doc, Babe Ruth called a 2-run home run, and his whole theory was gone.
And he also set the climate for the Yankees because they became the Bronx Bombers. Now, John McGraw, you know, one of the problems how this whole thing started with the band was McGraw wanted to get a black pitcher to pitch to him. When John McGraw died, they said he had a list of names of black players had he been able to take them that he would have had on his team.
Mm-hmm.
The great John McGraw.
But John McGraw and Connie Mack. And people look at Connie Mack and they're like, yo, that big dog, white. Well, you know he had to be racist. And granted, the Philadelphia team never really had blacks during his time, but there are documents, and the gentleman was asking me earlier about, you had to really probably have to dig up really deep to find this research. No, you don't. It's just that people don't want to write about it. It's like, it's not like you got to go into some secret vault. You can go on Google right now and say Babe Ruth and Pop Lloyd, and they'll tell you that Babe Ruth's best friend was an African-American baseball player named Pop Lloyd. You know, we just don't get this information because we're catching what the media is sending us. But
you talk about that, the dovetail of that. You know, you have this thing today, and I think a quick chance here, DocStanleySports.com, that's my site. As you know, that's part of the Trust in God Sports and Deaf Entertainment Automax Museum. And, you know, and you have this big thing today of no autographs and all this sort of stuff. And it's a known fact that Walter Winchell hung out with Sugar Ray Robinson. I mean, riding down the street that he was in Sugar Ray's pink Cadillac. Who made Howard Cosell but Muhammad Ali?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, but these things you never hear about. One of the closest friends to the great Larry Bird, and Larry Bird was a great, great batter, was none other than the great forward who was playing with Julius Erving, who was considered the next Elgin Baylor, was George McGinnis. But never hear about the associations of African Americans with people of grand status in this country because of that. I mean, I don't know if people know that Booker T. Washington was the first African American invited to the White House. Theodore Roosevelt invited Booker T. to the White House, and all hell broke loose to a certain degree. The Booker T. was a little reserved now, you know what I mean? And the Klan said, no problem. We'll handle it. Maybe we've done this story. We'll handle this. Okay? We was going to go down to the train station and just pull him off the train. Well, they went down to the train station, and they couldn't find Booker T. But then, lo and behold, Booker T showed up at the White House. Now, the reason why they couldn't find Booker T, because when Booker T got on the train, he brought his own private compartment. They didn't think a black man had the wherewithal or the money to buy his own compartment. So when they didn't see him sitting out there with the rest of the people in the back, they figured he wasn't there. So that's why the Klan didn't get Booker T, and why Booker T became the first black man to be invited to the White House. Sammy Davis Jr. was the first African-American that slept over at the White House, as Richard Milhouse Nixon invited Mr. Wonderful to stay at the White House. Doc Stanley, Sports Network on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports Network, the show. We're hoping our First Lady of Blake Radio did the show listening. We're going to make this a special and submit it to Blog Talk Radio. It's Byron Hunter, the Universal of Roberto Clemente, as it turned out, and Babe Ruth. Byron, you also talked about how what he did for Latin baseball and how he changed the mindset and course of baseball in Japan, Byron.
Latin America is a pretty amazing, you know, story, obviously. But, again, Babe was asked towards the end of his career to open up baseball in Mexico. The president of the country actually had asked Babe and said, look, we have seen what baseball is doing in the Caribbean and in the United States, and we want to open a professional baseball league. Again, the American media and the American baseball community jumped all over Babe and was like, how the hell are you going to help these people, and why are you doing this? You know, as opposed to, wow, we want to expand baseball on a global level. They were questioning Babe why he did it. But he did it anyway. And what he did was he couldn't go down to play because he was under contract, but he basically served as kind of a quasi-commissioner to draw other players. And Monty Irvin, and there were a number of African-American players who were the first to play in the Mexican League. And quite amazingly, when I did sit down with Monty Irvin, who is a tremendous person, even at 90, whatever he is, I spoke with him last year down in Houston where he lives. You know, he was telling me, Byron, even in Mexico, and I think I told you this the other day, Doc, and this is something I definitely want to say to your audience, is that when I talked to Monty Irvin, one of the great baseball players of all time, one of the
Byron, hold on. Monty Irvin, in 1951, joined Willie Mays in center field, and
Hank Thompson
in right field, became the first all-black outfield to play in the World Series. Monty Irvin became the first black man to lead the National League in RBIs. And Monty Irvin, in his first World Series game, came to the plate his fifth time up, 4-for-4, and had stole home in his first World Series game. Monty Irvin was 4-for-4, had stole home in his first World Series. And as a youth, Monty had a problem with his arm, and they were thinking about amputating his arm. But his mother said no. No, he couldn't. No, you can't do that in a glove. Monty Irvin was a guy who was looked at to be the first black man to break the baseball color line. It wasn't Jack Roosevelt Robinson. It was Monty Irvin. But Harvey Farmer, who wrote the great book about the World Series, said he knew Monty. Monty said he'd have killed somebody. But Monty Irvin, idol of Roberto Clemente, the first black man to lead the National League in RBIs, the mentor of Willie Mays. And now, without further ado, Byron Scott will again expound on the great Monty Irvin Hall of Famer. Go ahead, Byron.
And another thing you got to keep in mind about Monty Irvin is that he has something that I don't think anybody else in the world has. Monty Irvin was a batting champion in the National League, in the Negro Leagues and Major Leagues. Monty Irvin won a world championship in the Negro Leagues and the Major League. Monty Irvin did things that, you know, a lot of other guys didn't do. Jackie won one with the Brooklyn Dodgers, but he never won one with the KC Monarchs. You know what I'm saying? Roy Campanella won one. He never won one. So, you know, Monty was a tremendous figure. But I'm going to expound on two things that you told me real quick. One, and then go back to what I was going to tell you. One is that Monty Irvin, when he hurt his arm, Monty was – I just want to make sure I get the schools right, too. Monty was – just out of high school, he was a high school All-American in New Jersey, considered probably the best athlete in the state of New Jersey. He had been recruited to the University of Michigan where he was going to be a star football player at the University of Michigan. He hurt his arm in the seat in the summer before he went to Michigan. Michigan retracted his scholarship. Retracted his scholarship because he was hurt. Other people of other colors, they would have let him redshirt even back then, even though they didn't have redshirting back then, because the first 2 years you didn't play varsity sports anyway. So how is it that if he wasn't going to play varsity sports, would they retract his scholarship? But that's another debate for another time. What happened, though, because he lost his scholarship, he didn't know where he was going to go to school. A family friend called him and said, here's an opportunity, and I believe he went to Lincoln, and he was an All-American football player before he signed with the Newark Eagles. So Monty was a tremendous person in many different levels. When it comes to baseball, he told me he was approached by Branch Rickey 2 years before they went to Jackie. 2 years before they went to Jackie. So he said Byron, there were a number of people before Jackie. So again, I think you're right in expressing, Doc, that Jackie wasn't the first. He wasn't even in the first five or six. I came out to Orlando Cepeda. He told me about a guy named Silvio.
The thing that made Jackie, the late, great Buck O'Neill, considered the black Lou Gehrig, or Lou Gehrig was the white Buck O'Neill, said that they felt Jackie was the best suited because of his age, because he had some military time behind him, some college time, and that he had commingled and intermingled with white people. That was the thing they felt that made Jackie apropos. It wasn't strictly talent, because there was guys that were superior to Jackie as a player. Go ahead, Byron.
But you said right, Jackie had already commingled with white ball players. When I think he was a star running back, as you said in college, what was it, USC?
UCLA.
UCLA.
He was the first. He's the first four-letter man in the history of UCLA. Baseball was the sport that he was least effective in. Duke Snyder became a Jackie Robinson worshiper. Because he used to see Jackie play. He told the great story how great an athlete Jackie was. He saw Jackie come off the field, throw his glove down, and run toward the track. And he said, Jackie, where are you going? Jackie said, well, I'm going to go do the high jump real quick and come on back. He said, you know, the guy that they got, he ain't all that good. Jackie won the high jump, and came on back and continued playing shortstop, you know. So the story. Go ahead, Byron.
Yeah, but again, I think that's something that you guys need to think. We need to all think about again, because everybody goes through all this thing of how they chose and what kind of calculations that they picked to get Jackie Robinson. But I think that we got to deal with the reality. Four or five other people turned it down before Jackie took it, so it wasn't like they were looking for Jackie Robinson. They were looking for Monty before they looked for Jackie. Monty got asked. It wasn't like they considered Monty and then didn't ask him. They asked him, and he said no. There were four other guys who said no. So it wasn't like they were looking for Jackie. He just ended up being the best fifth choice. You know what I'm saying? So that in history we got to look at as well, because I thought about that when I talked to Monty. And I was like, shit, they were thinking about Monty a year before that. They weren't thinking about Jackie.
Hey, Byron, I'd like to ask you, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but Jackie Robinson's brother, Mac Robinson, was a fantastic Olympian, won a silver medal running behind Jesse Owens. And I'd like to ask you, do you know whether his brother played any baseball?
His brother didn't play in baseball, but his brother also had a great collegiate career at UCLA. So Mac did his thing. I don't think Mac played baseball. I'm trying to think of what else, because there was another guy who was also a very prominent guy at that time. Oh, another gentleman by the name of Ralph Metcalf.
Metcalf
was a bad dude with Jesse in there, too. So, but, yeah, Mac was a great runner. And I think, I'm not sure, I think he actually went into another sport. He might have gone into football, if I'm not mistaken.
Real quickly, gentlemen, the first lady of Blake Radio Sports has joined us, Deirdre Shuler. So, Deirdre, if there's a question you have for Mr. Hunter, please jump right on in. First lady? I guess she's just going to listen then. You know, the thing about Jackie, too, in the autobiography of the great Hal Jackson, which was it's must reading, you know, Hal was a guy who knew all of these people, being the radio personality he was. He said, you know, and we look, you know, there was a time, due to the severity of the death threats and everything, that Jackie had seriously considered about just letting the whole incident go. The late, great Art Russ Rooney, and I'm coming at you, you know, Art Russ told me something that I found very profound, that Art Russ said he thought there would never, ever be a black baseball player. And we're revealing here today on Sports in Depth, which we say, you know, we go deep
and we delve deep and we come up with the truth and facts you've never heard before. That and it's true, there were a lot of guys considered ahead of Jack and Monty Irvin. One of the reasons why they pulled back too, Monty, after coming out of the military, had some problems with his ears and his balance was a little something like that. So they kind of pulled back. But it was Monty Irvin, the mentor Willie Mays, who was looked at to be the first African, Negro, Black, or call it A, B, C, or D player in the history of Major League Baseball. Byron, can we get back to, you know, we know what Babe did for Latin baseball now. Now, Japan, you talked yesterday. He's at the end of his career. It's a downhill side. Babe goes to Japan. Bingo, the Triple Crown. He does it for the Orient.
Yes. He goes in 1934. He was asked to go in 1931, but at that time he was still at the height of his powers. At 34, what most people don't realize is he was at the end of the line with the Yankees. That summer, because he went to Japan in November, so that summer, the end of that baseball season, he had basically been let go. He was trying to renegotiate a deal with the Yankees, but they said, we're not going to pay you anywhere near what we've been paying you. So he basically left. So he goes to Japan, and again, he doesn't even have a job when he gets to Japan. He literally doesn't have anything to do when he comes back to the States. He doesn't know where he's going to play. And he goes to Japan. He's depressed. He's not in the best of moods. But again, he gets there. When a team arrives in Japan, there are 500,000 people waiting at the station, and they literally follow these guys. They have to go through a barrage of like 1,000,000 people to get to their hotel. So he got so excited about that his bat got excited too, and he hit a bunch of home runs. He did a number of things, but he also was just a great celebrity figure because they had heard the legend of Babe Ruth for all these years, and they were hoping, wow, when he comes over, we hope he can live up to it. He didn't think he was going to be able to, but he did. And he hit all these home runs and left as a god. The emperor of the country invited him to dinner, basically made a statement after Babe left and said, "What, based upon the excitement and the high level of baseball that he's brought here, we are going to rededicate ourselves to becoming a baseball country. And our goal will be that within the next so and so many years to be somewhat equal to American baseball." And that all came just from his visit. The next year they started their first team, their first league. In 35, they started the first league, but in 34, they took the team of players that had played against Babe and the other American All-Stars during that exhibition and converted that group of players into what they called the Tokyo Yomiuri Giants. So whenever you hear about the Yomiuri Giants, they were created because that was the same team that played against Babe Ruth when he came in 1934. I had the opportunity, Doc, to sit down with Hideki Matsui, who I've known for a number of years, obviously, just through my work with the Yankees. And I sat down with Hideki just without even prepping him, and went to his interpreter and I said, you know, just have Hideki tell me, what does Babe Ruth mean to Japanese baseball? Hideki comes up and looks at me and says, Babe Ruth is the father of our sport. He is the godfather. He is everything that you could think of who we are as a baseball nation is Babe Ruth. And I said, are you serious? And he said, if he didn't come in 1934, we'd still be playing high school baseball. And this is Hideki Matsui. This is not somebody who's 80 years old. This is the guy now. I've run into 17-year-old kids who are Japanese and know who Babe Ruth is. Amazing.
Let me ask you a quick question, Brian, and pardon me for cutting you off. But I have to ask you that since you mentioned Ruth and obviously his prowess in hitting home runs, does Sadaharu Ozu own the Japanese record for home runs over there?
What is the question? Does Sadaharu
Ozu? Yeah, I said to your knowledge. I mean, obviously we know what Ruth means here, but I wanted to know their home run hitting legend, if you will. Sadaharu Ozu still owns their record over there for hitting home runs.
No, he owns every record. Sadaharu Ozu hit 868 home runs. So Babe hit 714, Hank hit 755. Can't remember what Bonds hit. What, 770, 760? I can't remember what Bonds hit. Sadaharu Ozu hit 868. So he's technically the world home run champion. But we don't acknowledge that because we're America, so we tend to acknowledge what is American first.
Byron, are there ballparks over there? Byron, are their ballparks similar in size to ours? Or are they much smaller, you know?
No, they are. That is a misconception that people have. You got to hit it 400 feet to get out of a Japanese stadium, too. You got it. You got it. They don't have 250 states. You got it 385, 4, whatever. It's 335, baby. But, you know, one of the big issues, and this is one of the reasons I could answer your question, that made Babe Ruth a demagogue, because when the Japanese first learned about baseball, they learned from the Americans, right? So when the first stadiums were built in Japan in the early 1900s, they were built under the same dimensions of American stadiums. The only problem was the Japanese aren't half the size and half the strength of American players. So until Babe Ruth came in 1934, nobody had really seen anybody hit a home run out of a stadium in Japan. So now, if you think about it, if you've gone to baseball all of your life and you've never seen anybody hit a home run, or maybe on a fluke somebody hits a home run, then all of a sudden Babe Ruth rolls into town and hits 18 in like 18 games. You're like, yo. So that is part of the impact that he had there.
I'm sorry.
I just want to ask this, you know. Would you know if Sadahara, who he patented his baseball style and home run power after Babe Ruth? I mean, you know, emulated him or try to develop his home run prowess?
That's a great question. Absolutely not, because if you see Sadahara's batting style and the way he hits home runs, you know who emulates his style the most. You know whose style? If you look at a player today, you know who would look like Sadaharu O? Ishido.
Suzuki?
Well, actually,
yep.
Ishido raises his right leg. Yeah, but you know what? The guy that he emulates the most was the guy who was the all-time home run king, National League-wise, 511 home runs. The late great, and I remember his name because his first name was Melvin Thomas. The way he cocked that leg was the way Mel Ott did. Mel Ott, and it shows you how great Babe Ruth was. Babe Ruth retired, he had 714 home runs. Okay, the number two man was Mel Ott with 511. Okay, so Babe Ruth still had over 200 more home runs than his next competitor. With Willie Mays hit 600 home runs, he was the first man outside of Babe Ruth to ever do it. When Hank Aaron did it, he was only the third, you know. So that's the major. Real quickly, getting a chance to talk about the Touch and Guard Sports Hall of Fame. Some years ago, I ran into some beers. They go Casey's Lager Beer, and they had a picture of Richie Ashburn on one, a picture of Whitey Ford on one, and a picture of Monty Irvin. And let's read what the beer, I got this can autographed. It says, Monty Irvin, left field, New York Giants. And the quote from Monty Irvin: the greatest thrill of my career was October 4th, 1951, in the World Series against the New York Yankees. In the first game of the series, I stole home and batted 4-for-5. I went on to lead the series with 11 hits. The Yankees won the championship 4-2. So that's validating what I said there. 4-for-5 and stole home. It also says here, because of the color barrier, Monty did not reach the big leagues until he was 30 years old. One of the National League's premier right-handed hitters, he was selected into the Baseball Hall of Fame by the Special Committee in 1973 in recognition of his outstanding play in the regular leagues. The great Monty Irvin. So that's something.
Byron, I wanted to know, what did Babe Ruth think of Josh Gibson? Did you have a comment on Josh Gibson hitting balls?
First of all, that's a good question. I spoke with Monty Irvin about that. Monty says that he, to his knowledge, never saw Josh. Josh and Babe never met. But they knew about each other and respected each other, and Babe had a tremendous respect and wanted to play against Josh. Babe did play against Chuck Page, though.
Wow.
And Babe did hit a home run off of Satchel Paige, what I heard was the center field. So he didn't hit him all the time, but Babe definitely got Satchel once or twice.
Josh Gibson died in January 1947, died of the January before Jackie. Hold tight. Josh died the January prior to Jackie breaking the color line. And if you were at the affair yesterday, Jim Robinson, who will be with us next week, said that one of the things that bothered Josh that was that he wasn't picked to be one of the first guys to play, and he drank himself to death. Now, in 1944, Bill Veeck was going to buy the Cleveland Indians, and he was going to make them. Now, somebody, okay, gentlemen, you got to watch the back, the sounds in the background. Your telephone is a mic, so we got to muffle the background sounds. Okay, 1944, Bill Veeck is going to buy the Cleveland Indians. And what he's going to do with the Cleveland Indians, he's going to make it an all-black team. He's going to have Sacks. Mm-hmm. He's going to have Josh. Mm-hmm. He's going to have Willie Wells, Pop Lloyd. On Friday, the deal is just about set. On Monday, all he has to do is dot the I's, cross the T's. Somebody tells the commissioner. When Veeck comes in Monday morning, they say, what team? We sold the team over the weekend.
So, Mitchell, put that out,
what's that? And
hello. I was gonna speak today when you went that traffic. If I tell you, it doesn't look like mine.
Okay, Byron, you want to continue now?
Hello.
Yeah, Byron, go ahead, continue.
Okay, cool. But you know, another thing that you need to know about Monty, and I know we're kind of jumping across some things every once in a while, but Monty Irvin, you talked about his stealing home in the World Series and everything. What Monty won't tell you, and what you will probably be able to look up and read, is that the New York Giants that season were about 10 games out of first place with 30 days to go. They may have even been farther behind. Monty batted like 400 and something for the last 2 weeks of the season, or 3 weeks of the season, or 400 or 500, and got them into the playoffs, which they won. When, you know, Willie Mays and them won, where Willie Mays made the catch. If it wasn't for the last 3 weeks of the season, what Monty Irvin did, they don't even get in the playoffs. Because remember, this wasn't like it is now, where 5 or 6 teams get in. You had to win the thing.
It's, 1951, in August of 1951, they were 10.5 games behind Jackie Robinson's Dodgers. Monty had been put at third base by the Rocha. And Andre Monte kind of didn't like third base. DeRocher then switched. And Bobby Thompson, who Willie Mays had supplanted out of center field, came back. He put Thompson at third base, put Monte out in left field. Like you say, the rest, they say, is history. They caught the Dodgers. Bobby Thompson hit the famous home run against the Dodgers.
Perillo.
Against Ralph Barranca, and put him in the World Series. Dr. Stanley Sports is up on the Blick Network Rainbow Soul Channel. Sports Endeavor, the show, Universal Bay, Universal Clemente. Yeah, he is
Universal Baseball tonight.
What's that?
I said it's all Universal Baseball tonight. We're talking
Universal
about everything.
Baseball. And the voice you hear, ladies and gentlemen, is Byron Hunter. So, Byron, real quickly, name some of your other documentaries you've done.
I did my first major one was called, the first documentary that I did was a series that was called Then and Now, that actually aired on TV1 and was hosted by James Brown, who we call JB. And those were on a number
of football fame, Byron?
I'm sorry?
Of football fame?
No, not JB.
JB,
not Roy. The football,
right,
James Brown,
yeah, James Brown, sure.
The sportscaster. Yeah. Go ahead, Byron.
But through him, we were able to do a number of documentaries under the Then and Now series, where we told some incredible stories about athletes such as the New York Wrens basketball team, the Harlem Renaissance Five, we should call them properly, Bob Douglas's great team. We did a documentary on Kermit Washington, who many don't know his incredible story, because we only know him as a guy who knocked Rudy Tomjanovich and almost killed him with one punch. But he's a far more complex person than that. Most people don't
realize.
Tell us
something about it, Byron, quickly. Tell us something about him real quickly.
Well, first of all, what people don't realize about Kermit Washington was that Kermit Washington grew up in Washington, D.C., and went to, I think it was either American or one of the schools, but he was one of the first black academic All-Americans. He was the first black to be an All-American, academic All-American, and an All-American as a basketball player. He was also the first person to lead the NCAA in rebounds and scoring in one season. But by the time he got to the NBA, people were so intimidated by him that, you know, he became this monster type of personality, even though he was a very gentle guy and an extremely brilliant and intelligent individual. By the point that he had knocked out Rudy Tomjanovich, he was basically labeled as an animal You know what I mean? And most people thought he was kicked out of basketball, but quietly he remained in the league for about 4 or 5 years after the massive suspension they gave him. He saved all his money and retired from basketball as a very wealthy man. And most recently, when we did a documentary about him, he had just helped to build a hospital in Nigeria, in the worst shanty in Nigeria called Kabara, and was doing humanitarian work around the world. So Kermit Washington is not just the guy that knocked out Rudy Tomjanovich. He's a brilliant, successful businessman who's done incredible stuff around the world.
Okay,
and you know, survival punch because he was hit, and when he turned around, he was hit in the back.
It was basically a reaction punch. But I want to slide. We can get that in 2 seconds.
Right.
Can you tell us also? You did the documentary about foreign basketball too, Byron.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We did the documentary that came. Yeah, it came out in 2010. It was called Ambassadors of Hoops, and Dr. Stanley happened to be at the premiere that we had. But the general impetus behind that film is that what we wanted to do was that we wanted to showcase the history of basketball players, mostly African-American males and females, who, albeit the NBA and WNBA, have become superstars and legends in basketball all around the world. Right now, there are probably 200 to 300 African-American men and women playing in Europe professional basketball right now, and most of them are making somewhat short of $1 million, if not more. So there's an entire industry of black athletes participating in sports around the world that we don't even see or know about. And that was the reason we did that film, and we were able to highlight a great history, even to this day, of some of the great African-Americans, Latinos, Asians who have now left America and are superstars in countries and we don't even know about them.
Yeah, as been Byron, hold tight. Okay, Byron, what we want here? Your background, where you're from, where it all started for you.
I'm from Dallas, Texas, and I grew up to a family of mother who, ironically, I'm from Texas. My parents are both from Texas. My father being from a small town called Longview, my mother being from Houston, Texas. But ironically, they met as students at Howard University, where they both graduated. My dad got his master's there before going on to get his doctorate at University of Pennsylvania. My mother got her bachelor and master's degree in early childhood development at Howard. Eventually, by the time they had me, they had moved back, and my father was working at Bishop College. So I was immediately born into the whole HBCU network and understanding our history in terms of black colleges, and actually got to see a gentleman when I was very small by the name of Emmett Thomas, who played for Bishop and became a Hall of Famer in the NFL. He was a very good friend of the family. But I eventually came to New York as I got older to come to college, and the first year I got here, I ran into a gentleman by the name of Arthur Ashe. I was a 22-year-old kid who had a lot of ambition but didn't know a lot, and Arthur took me under his wing and just taught me about what sports really was and not what the newspapers write. And so my journey in sports has always been based upon Arthur telling me, and I'll never forget Arthur telling me this. He said, "Byron, never blame anybody for not reporting our history. If our history is not reported, it's our fault. And if you are truly down with understanding our culture, you will do just like me, and you will document our history, and you will put it out there whether you make a bunch of money or not, because it has to be about the sacrifice for the culture and not necessarily about the love of money." And he told me even before Mr. Ash died of AIDS, he said, "Let me tell you, Byron, sports is changing. Money is changing our African-American men. And I dread to believe or understand where sports will be in the next 20 years if we continue just to focus on making money and we lose our sense of culture in sports."
Wow.
And that was in
1993. You know, you talk about Arthur. I remember talking to Arthur. Doc Stanley, Sports Network, the Blake Network, Rainbow Soda Channel, Sports Network, the show. Fellas, don't worry. It's going to be mic on, lights off. You know it's got to happen here. We got Byron, and we ain't letting him go. Met Arthur. After he just won Wimbledon, beating Jimmy Connors, and I asked him had he felt, you know, being the Jackie Robinson of tennis. I've long gotten over that. But the last time I saw Arthur Ashe, I was with the great Larry Hardis, who opens up our show, greatest African sportscast in history, and mm-hmm. there's a little fair over in, I think it was Newark, Sharp mm-hmm. James,
right.
Earl Monroe was there.
Right, yep. That was Newark, I remember.
And Larry was going to MC it, and we got over there, and I interviewed Arthur, and the last words I heard Arthur said, because Arthur and Larry were close too, and he said, "Talk to you later, Larry," and Arthur died shortly after that. I'm going through a Boy's Life magazine, and I'm looking, and there's a story about Arthur Ashe. The picture they're using is me giving my last interview that Arthur Ashe did, and it's a treasured piece. And I remember I had met him another time at another fair, and I went over and I went to introduce myself, and he reacted the same way Larry Hardis did. He said, hey, I know who you are. I'm a subscriber. Arthur subscribed to all of the African-American newspapers. He was like Dusty. He inhaled, he digested, he dissected. He diffused all of the African-American papers, read them daily, and his likes will never be esteemed. Arthur's all about character, credibility, honesty, integrity. You know, that great song, they can't take that away from you. They can't take away your integrity. The great song about Ali, the greatest love of all, they can take what they want from me, but they can't take away my dignity. And anytime you think of Arthur Ashe, Byron Hunter, Ali, you think of class, character, and dignity. Traits that these gentlemen on my panel have. A great line I say by Walt Whitman, "I no doubt deserve my enemies, but I doubt if I deserve my friends." And these guys are a great collection, and we're going to continue with Byron. Okay, Byron, now you got your college background, you're married, you're single, the colleges that you attended, and the first project that propelled you into the area that you are now.
Well, I have not been married. I don't know if that's within God's will, but we'll see what happens. I'm still, I'm not removing that possibility, but I haven't been married. I went to Rutgers, and the reason I went to Rutgers was because I grew up with a tremendous affinity for Paul Robeson. Also, due to my tremendous love for Paul Robeson, I've learned a number of languages, and I speak about three or four of them.
Well, what language, Myra? What language?
I speak German, I speak Italian. Well, you want me to speak them? Ich spreche Deutsch. Ich bin auf Deutschland gelebt für nearly 3 years. So I speak Deutsch, I speak German, I speak Italian, I speak Spanish. I speak, let me see, get all my languages here. German,
well, you know, if you speak
English,
Spanish and Italian, then you have no problem with Portuguese either.
I don't mess with Portuguese too much. I hire an interpreter when I go there. I also really never caught French too well, but I try. But I couldn't figure out how I figured out German and Italian, but I haven't figured out French. But that's another story.
Amazing.
But what I've been able to do is really just try to dedicate as much of my life to inspiring people, especially people of color, through just us understanding our own history. Like we talked about yesterday, there are a lot of people that don't know that from 1925 to 1932, there was a black, all-black racing circuit of race car drivers that raced through Ohio, Illinois, et cetera. They had probably a dozen races a year with 30 cars in each race, and all the car drivers and the pit crew and everybody was African-American. It was called the Golden Glory Championship. They actually had a race at Indianapolis 500 every year called the Golden Glory Championship. And so, you know, people need to know this because I think that we become prouder and stronger as a race when we understand the depth of our history. And so Arthur and Tim Reed and Daphne Reed, obviously, who adopted me later and got me into doing documentary films, and, you know, a number of people, Comer Cottrell is a tremendous influence of mine, and I think he's somebody that we, especially as African-Americans, need to put in our vernacular of history. Comer Cottrell owned a company called Proline Hair Care Products Company that we all used back in the 70s and 80s. But one of the most influential things is that Comer Cottrell was the first African-American to ever be a principal owner of a major professional sports franchise when he owned the Texas Rangers back in the late 80s and early 90s. And people don't know that. And he has set a strong example for the future owners, including Magic now, because he did it first.
Oh,
so Magic
yeah,
is not the first African-American to be a major owner. He's not even a major owner. He's a very small minority owner of the Dodgers, but he's a spokesperson. Comer was an owner. Like, he owned 25% of the team. He didn't own 2%. He owned a mass majority of the team.
A majority of percent.
with all you've done, Byron, with all you have accomplished, because it's, I mean, I know you could go on for the next centuries.
Hold on, Dusty. What are we going to come back? Hold on. Okay, gentlemen, we got to make our mic on, lights off. We got to break out and come right back. We're not going to leave Byron. Doc Stanley Sports Network on the Blake and the Rainbow Soul Sports Network show. Larry Hardesty is going to take us out and bring us back as we'll go with mic on, lights off. Byron Hunter's in the house. We are chaining. He's not. No, hey, don't move another fella.
This concludes another edition of Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley. We thank you for listening and encouraging you to tell a friend about Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley. You can hear that and many other great programs on the Blake Radio Network. Have a great day. Welcome to Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley on the Blake Radio Network. On each and every show, Doc takes you inside the world of sports to hear from the movers, shakers, and decision makers. I know you thought there were seven wonders of the universe, where here's the eighth, Doc Stanley.
And talking about makers and shakers, this is Michael and Lights Off, and dear Lord, we thank you for all good things and wonderful, and we thank you for Byron Hunter tonight. Ask you blessing, all the blessings, in the name of your darling son, Jesus. Amen. And without further ado, gentlemen, it's time for Mic On, Lights Off. So now the questions can flow, and don't you go, because you won't be able to get back in now. Doc Stanley Sports Network on the Blake, with the New York Rainbow Show, the Channel Sports Network show. It's Universal Byron Hunter, who happens to be talking about Babe Ruth, Roberto Clemente, and Arthur Ashe. Also, I want to let you guys know that, as always, top of the show, DocStanleySports.com. That's my site. And this Tuesday, Arizona will be visiting me again. But without further ado, let the questions continue as we now continue to talk to our special guest, our special historian, the one and only, Mr. Byron Hunter. And leading up with the first question is none other than the man who got a chance to meet, talk, and know the great one, Roberto Clemente Walker, our own Latin expert extraordinaire, Destino Baby Lewis. Dusty, you can start the questions. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Doc. I mean, the check is in the mail.
Send cash, Dusty. Send cash.
Cash? Cash? I send Roscoe with the cash. But, you know, sometimes we go off and we go goof around on this, Byron, so don't take us serious. I know Doc and I have been married for over 40 years, and we still fight like newlyweds, so don't worry about that.
You know, you were on the show last time. I was on the show 3 years ago. And I think you were on there 5 years ago when I was on the show, too. So this ain't new for all of us, man. I just feel blessed to be here and be part of it.
Okay, I'm glad. God bless you. The thing is that intrigues me that you have done so much, okay, and you've accomplished so much. Is there any other project or any other field in terms of these documentaries that you may have thought about, have not thought about, and will one day in the future will do, as you know, in conjunction with what you're doing now?
Well, to be quite honest, Seth, I really wish I could make it that easy, but again, my heart is so full of so much information that I already realize I won't be able to tell half of the stories that I've been blessed to have possessed in my spirit. But one of the things that, going back to something that Doc and I were talking about yesterday, is that I got a thousand of them I'd like to do, but one of them, since we're on account of the Latino tinge, is that we talked about one of my other friends who I loved very dearly until he passed, and Doc knew very well, was Jose Chegui Torres. And Chet Lee was a tremendous friend that I loved very dearly. I actually interviewed him at his retirement party when he was moving back to Puerto Rico. And I never realized why I sat with him. That was going to be the last time I ever saw him.
Wow, isn't it?
So one of the things that he taught me about, and I think it's important before we sign off on here, is that Chet Lee Torres, and Doc, you elaborate on it, Chet Lee Torres forced Madison Square Garden to create the first situation ever in professional sports where the Puerto Rican national anthem was played before or any other national anthem other than the United States in a major sporting event was when they played the Puerto Rican national anthem to Chegui Torres.
That's the story that people need to understand.
On
a weekly basis, Doc mentions that fact, Byron. So believe me, that is not lost on us, and especially Doc. He mentions that fact on almost a weekly basis that he stood firm in making sure that that anthem was played along with
the Jose became a friend of mine, and that affair, that's where I first met you, Byron, and the reason why I met you there, and I really don't want to mention who had me come there, but I've got no choice. It was Dusty. But on the real side,
yeah.
Dusty had told me, hey, they're having something for Jose. And,
oh, yeah, remember that? Yeah.
And then he called
me
again.
Yeah, man, that's the last time I saw you.
And he called, he said, hey, I'm over here waiting for you, coming or not. Juan Laporte was there. And you know, Jose.
My old cool mate.
Jose was just a tremendous friend. And he's the reason why in my Trust in God, Sports and Death Entertainment Artifact Museum, one of my most prized possessions is a boxing jacket. Don King, I found that I was the first man ever to give Don King an on-the-air radio interview when I worked with my first mentor, Dr. Frank Bannister, Mutual Black Network Radio. Well, Don hired me to do some work, security work, knowing that I was a police officer, to work with Tony Tucker, who was having this huge fight with Lennox Lewis. And when we got to Arizona, Kevin Brown said, hey, Point, said I was the lead of security guards going out. So he said, look, we're all going to get this one-of-a-kind boxing jacket. Guy's going to come in, measure us, and the pattern we pick, after he makes it, he'll destroy it. And in the boxing jacket I had, on the back, I had two gloves and some lightning behind it, Tony TNT Tucker. Well, I had people sign inside the jacket, inside the gloves, then I had them sign behind in the lightning. And I gave the jacket to Jose to autograph, thinking he would sign on the back of the jacket. But I looked, as he was calmly talking, he signed on the sleeve. Therefore, I started having other people sign on the sleeve, and what has turned out, there's no fighter in the 20th century of merit, with the exception of Leon Spears, have to catch up, that's not on their jacket. I mean, you can't name a champion with Ali and Joe Frazier, Roberto Duran, Wilfredo Benitez, Tito Puntadet, Sugar Ray Leonard, Tommy Hearns, Ingemar Johansson, Floyd Pat. I even have a section of referees, but it was Jose Torres who had me to extend the signature line on the jacket, and he told me about the anthem. He told me about the great story about Muhammad Ali. He said, you know, Ali does everything wrong in boxing. He puts his hands down. He backs up. He said everything that you tell somebody not to do, he does.
Exactly.
But he can get away with it.
That was
at
his
one
own
time.
Table, huh?
Huh? Yeah. It was one time though. It was thought that Torres might have been the one guy that could have given Ali a pretty good run, but a great friend, a great loss when he beat Willie Pastrani for the title.
Yeah.
All of Puerto Rico went crazy. Big parade. Everybody listened to on TV. A great found that his wife, her biggest, her favorite baseball player at that time was Mike Piazza. But just some insight on the Trust in God, Sports and the Mac Hall of Fame, and the great Jose Torres. Byron, the questions are coming. Rooney, you got a question for Byron?
Well, I had, Doc. When you kind of threw me off when you kind of went in the other direction, you know, me getting a little older, it just basically just in my mind, but I'm sure it will. I do. You know, funny that you should say that in regard to your documentaries. You said you were thinking about doing something, and you kind of stole my thunder with the old question that I was going to ask you, Byron. But you're thinking about doing something, you know, on boxing and the great Jose Torres. I wanted to ask if you ever talked to him about being a disciple, if you will, of the great Customato, who, as you know, was the inspiration behind the career of one Michael Gerald Tyson.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I did talk to Chuck Wee about that, and obviously he loved Cuts as everybody else did. I won't get into his relationship with Jim Jacobs and the rest of them guys, but with Cuts, apparently this man was something that I would have really desired or treasured to meet of all the people I've met in sports because of the reverence that they have for him. So I don't know. He didn't sound like he was an overly brilliant or articulate person, but apparently his spirit and his love for people, because I've also talked to Mike Tyson about it quite a bit, and they are just both sold on Cuts as one of the greatest people that ever lived. So realizing what they did, I got to respect the guy. Another thing people should understand about Jose Torres is that, you know, we talk about sports and we talk about athletes who make a lot of money and who usually after their career is over don't do very much or whatever. Chuck Wee Torres was the complete opposite. He went from being an excellent boxer to being a better writer
and a better person
yeah.
than he was even when he was a boxer. He was a better writer than he was a boxer. He was a better
right.
diplomat and other things that he did in his career. And most people don't elevate out of sports to become greater, and I think that's what people should know about Che Guevara.
Yeah, and what was so funny about Che Guevara was the fact that he got into boxing because he didn't want to do any KP in the military. And in the military, you go TDY, which is temporary duty, perform, you know, sports and shooting your BAR and all that. And he said, I don't like it because, again, I'm not putting on airs. I got to know Che Guevara very close, and I knew his wife, Rabonita. In fact, he used to tease me. I said, I'm a better dancer than you are. We used to go to Hunts Point and try to outdance each other. But the idea was that he says, no, I didn't want to do any KP, so I became a boxer in the Army. And goes to show you the talent he had, because he went up to the silver medal in over in Australia. And he was a non-boxer. I mean, he just got in there to get out of KP. But you're right. To piggyback on what you said, he was a great humanitarian. He was always looking out. And then when he became boxing commissioner or deputy, was a full commissioner or deputy, the guy changed the climate, if you will, of the boxing commission. You know, it was all the non-minority, and he got himself a few inspectors and, you know, a few of the people who knew how to run the preliminaries and do, you know, and stop playing favorites. He ran a pretty good ship. I'm surprised and disappointed that he didn't stay there that long. But I think what got him out of there was his ambition to other things. You mentioned writing The Village Voice, and he wrote a lot of stories. And unfortunately, when he wrote that story about Mike, Mike did not like what he wrote about him, but he wrote it out of his heart. And I did get to know Customato. I used to be a fighter myself, and I got to know him in Gramercy Park, you know, when he used to train Floyd Patterson and all them guys out there before Mike Tyson. And Customato was a real philosopher, a real in-depth person who got inside your guts and talked to you. And I never forget him saying to us, he says, there's nothing wrong with going into the ring with a little bit of fear. That makes you a better fighter. And I just think this guy was he crazy? I mean, I'm going there. I'm not afraid of anybody, but what's wrong? But that little ounce of talking to you, of dealing with your little bit of fears, and would make you a better fighter. And I believe them too. You know, I believe that because that's what I utilize a lot of times, which meant caution, which meant watch what the other guy's going to do before you do something, and make you a better fighter.
But,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that, Dust. Not that, but I know that you're a former fighter, and it's funny. I remember recalling having a private conversation with Mike, and I said, you know, Mike, you know, you're knocking these guys out way too early, Mike. People are starting to believe that what you do is easy, man. And so, you know, we kind of shared a nerve. Really, Dust, so we shared this kind of hard enough. I'm like, Mike, guys think that what you do is easy, man. And he kind of looked at me and kind of rolled his eyes, Dust. So I'm like, yeah, easy. Yeah, real easy. They should try it. Because, Dust, you know, when you have a tendency to be being a knockout guy and knocking guys out early, people actually think, Dust, that what you guys do is easy, that you come knock some bum out in two or three minutes and go on home.
It was never easy.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, Jesse, you're talking about how Che Guevara learned boxing while he was in the Army.
Yeah.
There's another very famous Puerto Rican athlete who is another dear, dear friend of mine who also learned his craft in the Army and became a superstar. And he's got a little golf course down in Guayama, and his name is Chichi Rodriguez.
I knew you were going to say Chichi.
Chichi told me when I sat down with Chichi, who is another person, Chichi is in the Humanitarian Hall of Fame.
Exactly.
With Mother Teresa in it, okay? But Chichi, which is something nobody can explain because he's amazing, but Chichi got in the Army in the United States. He said they sent him to Texas, and what saved his life was he was a little bitty guy. He was in the Army, and everybody picked on him, but he said he was good at playing golf. He got so good playing golf in the Army, they actually moved him to an Army base in Oklahoma where everybody played golf.
And that's how he got in.
Stayed a golf course there. Yeah, he became a golfer in the Army.
correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't he own a golf club in Puerto Rico?
He has a golf course. He has a golf course in Guayama, Puerto Rico, right down there. It's called
Guayama,
El Legado.
Right.
And it's a tremendous, tremendous golf course. He actually raises catfish down there.
There's a couple of callers there, too, gang. So I'm down to Dusty and Rooney. Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Vitter Network, Rainbow Solar Channel, Sports and Depth for the show.
One of the networks, Doc, one of the calling networks. And I want to tell the great Deidre Schuler, who was on before, I don't know if she's still on, when I said I'm having trouble with the network, obviously I don't mean our radio network. I mean my, you know, our cell network. So
yeah, you know, we're down to just you two and Byron, and you spoke about custom model and Jose just learned so much. Jose, Cuss knew very well that Floyd Patterson could not beat Sonny Liston, and he kept coming back with these stories of excuses why he couldn't make the Liston-Patterson fight. And to Patterson's credibility as both a human being and a champion, he said, hey, you know, because the reasons were becoming numerous. One was that the guy had spent some jail time and he didn't deserve a title. And Floyd said, hey, look, the past is the past. He's the number one challenger. He deserved a shot at Curry Bales. Well, we know what happened. Cuss was so adamant, Jose told me, so adamant in his zeal and his test for the fight that he refused to take his manager's cut from both of those fights.
Because he didn't want Floyd, but you see, it was Cuss's fault, Doc.
No, I'm not even worried about the fact that here's a guy.
Yeah.
We're talking about a guy who stood on his own principles and his own mindset.
This is what I'm saying. It was Cuss's fault because he made him that way. He made
what
Floyd
that
Patterson that way.
Yeah, what
he
do you
made
mean,
him. He made him believe in himself. Coming from a background of delinquency, Floyd Patterson went to Wiltrake and all
I'm correct, I believe Patterson's from Texas too. I'm just saying the bottom line was that this is the fight that he knew that this kid couldn't win. I mean, the styles just wasn't there.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you see, you cannot take. Oh God, how can I explain this? You cannot take what you put into your pupil and take it out of him at a certain time. He said, no, you can't do this.
I agree with you on that. I'm just trying to say the guy, you know, the guy just felt. I mean, you look at Patterson, I'm surprised that supposedly, and I think it is something that you mentioned in the past shows that really was the reason why, or maybe it was Mike, that Marciano got out of boxing. It wasn't so much that he was running from Floyd Patterson, that he was running from Sonny Liston.
Well, yeah, the rumors, you know, the boxing community is a rumor monger. It's like a factory. Everybody talks and assumes and presumes and perceives and all that nonsense. Marciano, the story that they, if I can segue into it, Marciano was tired. He wanted to go, and he didn't want to fight anymore. He had been hurt. Ripped, almost stopped by Joe Walker, Joe Walker, injured and blasted by Archie Moore, almost stopped by Ezra Charles, you know, and the wear and tear. Now, he had one more fight, the nice 50th round fight. It was a choice. They were talking about Sonny Liston. They were talking about, Floyd Patterson. They were talking about Ernie Terrell. They were talking about all these guys. But Marciano was already going to the wear and tear. And he knew eventually that one of these guys was going to get to him.
Well, not only that, all those guys were young. The thing that you mentioned about all those guys, Dusty, all those guys that you mentioned in the past that gave him tough fights, and let's get back to, I'm going to make this point, get back to Byron. Those guys.
You forgot about Byron. Come on, Byron.
and what made those guys the fight that he didn't want.
But it's funny because I can relate to those as well, but I believe in love for that.
Well, the thing that made Liston, Terrell, and Patterson unappealing was they were all young. He had tough fights against older guys. We'll get back to that. Byron.
You just throw his name in there was Coley Wallace. They were also talking.
Coley Wallace had beat him in the amateurs.
In the amateurs. And they were trying to say, well, now we got Coley Wallace. And that's about the time that he says, no mas.
I'm going home.
She spoke Spanish too. Byron, we hear Let It Flow. We talked about other documentaries. The more you want to tell us about the Universal Babe Ruth. I mean, you had spoke some things. We spoke about the Japanese influence. We spoke about the Mexican. And you talked about how him going Keyshore Mountain Landis, which is an amazing story, Landis, and the fact that he was like the guy that got the white girls for Jack Johnson, and yet he was the guy that presided over the case implemented the Mann Act that
impressed.
Got Jack Johnson banned from the ran out the country. But Landis didn't like what Babe was doing with the Negro Leagues players.
He did not. And again, I think that, you know, again, when you look at Kennesaw Mountain Landis, he's a similar point. But he also brings back, and I know last time I mentioned the baseball writers, you all pulled me out of that, but I got to bring them back, is that, again, he in American folklore is actually viewed upon as a very good person. Kennesaw Mountain Landis, he was God. I'm like, this dude was bad news. But, yes, he was a control person. And I'm not going to say he was completely racist, but it's just ironic that he ruled baseball from 1920 to 1946, and until he died, we'd had no blacks in the league.
Mm-hmm.
But no one seems to be able to explain that to me, because they always have some type of explanation, like, oh, it wasn't his fault. I'm like, okay, whose fault was it?
Thing about it, too, Byron, was he was the guy, too, that presided over the case where the United States government went after
Jack Johnson
with the Mann Act. He presided over
the case,
and supposedly he was a hang time buddy with Jack Johnson. He was the guy getting the white girls for Jack. He was the guy that was hanging out with Jack Johnson.
And then all of a sudden,
he was the guy that presided over the Mann Act. I mean, as Howard Weston would say, sad and touching that the United States government personally went after Jack Johnson. And I read an article as much as maybe a year ago, that they still refuse to pardon the guy, even though he's dead.
You know, Doc, there's a famous piece of footage of Johnson supposedly being knocked out and losing the title, as you can clearly see him shedding his eyes from the sun.
Yeah, exactly. Holding his arm up and blocking the sun from being in his eyes.
You know what's amazing? December 26, 1908, Jack Johnson was heavyweight champion of the world. All hell breaks loose across America.
Yeah,
black people are lynched.
Yeah.
Black people are robbed. Black people are all and supposedly, as a defense for Jack Dempsey, his manager said he never wanted Dempsey to fight a black fighter because he didn't want that to ever happen again. You know,
nonsense.
Well,
he
I'm saying that's what
he said. Wills.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, but, you know, the thing with Jack Johnson is, you know, and when he fought the guy that came out of retirement, that was the first time, I mean, to show you, because white America thought the title was going to, when he fought, when he fought him, when he came out of retirement, because, you know, the White Hope, as the first time women were ever allowed at ringside out of the fight. It was the first time women were ever allowed ringside at a fight, and it was the first time we only had one fight, the main event. There was no undercard. The main event was Johnson defending his title against was Jim Jeffries or Jess Willard? I think it was Jeffries that came out of retirement.
Jess Willard.
Willard had came out of retirement. He beat Jeffries for the title. Willard came out of retirement, and that was the first time women, had to be white women, were allowed to sit ringside. And you only had the main event, but December 26, 1908, and the understanding was when Johnson lost the title, white America said no black man would ever fight for the title again. Joe Louis only got
and
the title, only
and
got
that's
the title.
What
understanding, only got the understanding that he would give 10% of his purse to the gentleman Jim Corbett,
the
Cinderella man, And the demeanor that Joe had was what the demeanor that they wanted of this, well, it's going to be a good fight, you know, I hope I win. And you have to understand something, too, here, was that, you know, Joe Louis, like I said, in giving the 10% of his purses was actually, to a certain degree, giving his whole life. I mean, who fought 10 years? So for the first 10 years of his career, Joe had to give 10% to the former champion, which meant that 90% was left out of 100%. And America had vowed. Sugar Ray Robinson was 5 years before he got a title shot. He was 77-0 before he got his title shot. 77-0.
Wow.
Ali didn't fight 77 fights. Ray,
no.
I think Ray Leonard and Tommy Hearns together didn't fight. Sugar
no.
Ray Robinson, on the night that he fought Tommy Bell, who's the uncle of lead singer James Bell from Kool & the Gang, Sugar Ray Robinson was 77-0. For 5 years, they wouldn't let him fight for the welterweight championship because they didn't want a black man to have the title.
Look, I have to ask you a question, otherwise I'd be remiss. I have to ask you this question, Doc, you being a legendary reporter and scribe, dusty former amateur champion and pro great, and a Byron, a great, you know, a biographer and videographer. I have this question
director.
For all three. Yeah, I have all, indeed. I have a question for all three. Has there ever been any more pressure on one single athlete in regard to one single event than Lewis in the Smelling fight?
Lewis Smelling fight.
Yeah,
I
has
always
there ever
say
been
this.
Any more pressure than
this.
On a particular athlete?
You know, it's amazing you said that because, you know, when Smelling knocked out Lewis the first time, okay, and the big thing here, was when Lewis got the fight against for the title against when he beat the Cinderella man
James Corbin
Braddock
when he beat Braddock. Okay. Now Smelling was also in the running and you know when Smelling knocked out Lewis that first time, there was a lot of sentiment towards Smelling. And the second time, one of the things that gave Joe the edge toward fighting Braddock was that he was American. But there was a lot of sentiment toward the white guy. Later for the American stuff, you know what I mean?
The master
and,
race.
Yeah, you see? And you have to understand, I'll never forget what Eddie Robinson said. The late Eddie Robinson. I got to do a story. Urban League is going to have a game, first time in 25 years. They're going to play this year, next year. Urban League. Eddie Robinson told me something I'll never forget. You know, I always said, you know, I've got some things he told me I'll never forget, and some jokes he told me. And I'm trying to remember. Mr. Robinson, we always used to tell each other jokes, and he told me that night, when Joe Lewis entered the ring, and the ring announcer said, "And the American, Joe Lewis, is entering the ring." Eddie Robinson, greatest coach in college football, black, white, green, and yellow, said, "That's the first time I ever heard a black man called an American." Now, all you have to know is what America thought of Joe Lewis is that the IRS say owed him over $1 million, okay? They taxed him to death, and I don't care where you bury him, give me what you have for me while I'm alive. The Honorable Susan Mendoza says, "One rose in the hand of the living is worth more than countless wreaths on the casket of the dead." Burying Joe Lewis in Arlington Cemetery don't take away the ache, the pain, okay, the disrespect you showed him. They took $661 that Joe Lewis' mother had in a savings account for him, the IRS. IRS did that. America the Beautiful. You know, pressure probably no greater for anybody that night. But, you know, if we look at that, there might have been nights, maybe every night, for Joseph Lewis Barrows, because his real name was Joe Lewis Barrows. He dropped the Barrows like Ray Robinson did in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So every night might have been like that night. But you have to understand that the boxing fan, who I felt has been the most intelligent and probably the most non-racist of all, the late Tommy Kenville, who we want to send tribute to his family and dedicate this show to, also talked about a night. And I'll tell you this, how America felt about Joe Lewis, okay? Because Lenny Lewin and all the old-timers, Bill Gallo, Art Rush Jr., Joe was their guy. Tommy Kenville tells a story, and we're coming back to you, Byron. It is a night, a Friday night in Madison Square Garden. All of a sudden, the lights go down. and the crowd is mumbling, what's going on? And Johnny Addy, the legendary ring announcer, says, ladies and gentlemen, Sergeant Joe Lewis, the spotlight comes on, standing at attention in his uniform with his stripes on, is Joe Lewis with a salute. Tommy Kenfield said, I thought they were going to tear down the garden. The building was shaking. He said, I thought the garden was going to fall. America loved Joe Lewis, the fan, the everyday fan. To a lot of people today, he's the greatest heavyweight champion of all time. Ali unquestionably is the best. But I think, Rooney, and we're getting back, I think the pressure on Joe Lewis was insurmountable all the time. But that night, Rooney, I think I can say for all of us, it was extra special because he was carrying that night. That night might have been the first time in his life, as Eddie Robinson said, that Joe Lewis was seen by everybody, if not a black man, not as a Negro, but as an American. Doc Stanley, Sports Devil on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soda Channel, Sports Devil the show. We have in-house Byron Hunter. Byron, the platform is yours. And you talked about the 1942 sentiment, pro-Nazi, you said, in America, Byron.
Well, actually, before we get into that, I'd kind of like to backtrack on just what
you all
were mentioning about Joe Lewis also and the pressure and the answer actually to the gentleman's question. And while I tend to agree that that would be probably the event, I would almost have to put as a 1A, and I know you guys are big boxing guys, so you might not think it is the same way, but I just want you to kind of look at my perspective. When Joe had fought Max Schmeling, he had fought him before, so he kind of knew what was up. He also realized that during the time when he was supposed to be training for the first Max Schmeling fight, he was playing 18 holes of golf every day. So he kind of knew he had a chance to beat this guy. Plus, he fought him in Madison Square Garden, so he's in America with 100 million people rooting for him. The whole world wasn't watching this fight. Who was watching it was the United States and the Germans. The rest of the world pretty much didn't care, but we see it that way. But Jesse Owens had to go into Nazi Germany, into Nazi Germany with the whole world, not just Americans and Germans, watching and expecting, because Hitler just got you saying black things like weird or macerate. In the 100 meters, he had his pressure. He wasn't that light either, because he had to prove to the whole world that this team weren't too great, the same way Joe Lewis had to do it. Now, Joe Lewis was an individual, and take again, I don't say it's any less, but Jesse went into Nazi Germany.
Great point. And I found out that Jesse
and Ralph Metcalf and Mack Brown, too. I mean,
everybody. And I found out last night that Jesse Owens actually was the first athlete ever to use and wear Adidas. The makers of Adidas, the two brothers, they went to Jesse and asked him. It's amazing that you talked about that. Speaking to Chief Petty of Nothing Known Them, Nazi Germany, these two Nazis, they went and asked Jesse to wear their sneaker. And Jesse Owens.
Absolutely.
And Jesse Owens was it wasn't called Adidas then. Exactly.
It was
ID. Go ahead, Byron.
Yeah, well, the name Adidas comes from the fact that there are the brothers who approach him with a Dossler brother.
Right.
Their last name is spelled Dassler.
Ivy is one
of them. So ID, the first three letters of his name and the last three letters of his name are Adidas.
Exactly.
His brother ended up getting into a fight with him. They ended up splitting, and Puma is his company.
There you go. And which is amazing that African-Americans were the ones to propel both of these sneakers, as Jesse wore the Adidas and his Walt Clyde Frazier, who's synonymous with Puma sneakers. Now, Byron,
listen to what you were talking about, because you all talk about Joe and after he won the fight and all of what the IRS and everybody did to Joe. But Joe still managed to finish his career before they started messing with him. Look what they did to Jesse Owens.
They did nothing
Jesse Owens' career was over 3 years after the Olympics. He didn't get to have 10 more years to defend the title like Joe Lewis. His career was over. He was racing horses, dog. Remember that? They had a race anything. You know what I mean?
Only in America, baby.
And he ended up broke and poor and dying in poverty. So it's like, dude.
Got a chance to meet Mr. Owens,
didn't he also beat Germany's star track guy,
hitting his favorite when he left him in the dust in that competition. Yeah, in the track and field. He beat, supposedly. This, I'm getting this from my dear late father, who was old for an athlete. And he remembered that he had beaten Hitler's favorite track man and left him in the dust. And this is one of the reasons why Hitler was so upset, because not only did Jesse Owens won the race, but he beat his favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a German a track star.
Exactly. And the thing was is that even when Smelling and Lewis fought, again, they fought in New York. They were in America.
Right.
Hitler was watching that shit like Jesse Owens, man. He was there. You know, so it's like, oh, shoot, man. This is crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
Tremendous point, man. And Jesse, a tremendous human being, the Jesse Owens dinner, which the late PR giant, my man Joey Goldstein, used to PR that with Dave Hersher. Got a chance to meet Mrs. Owens on a couple of occasions. Got a chance to meet Mr. Owens. In fact, has autograph and everything. And you're right, Byron, a tremendous athlete, a sad story, and the pressure, you know, so you see. It's funny, you know, we talked about the Adidas brothers, and yet in so many cases, they're looking at the athlete and not the color of his skin, you know, the content of his character. And, it's just kind of amazing how some people see color, some people see character. And yet
Absolutely.
You look at the sadness of, and, you know, people forget, you know, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, you know, the movement they made, that wasn't a solo move. That was supposed to be unity. But
no, all the Olympians were supposed to do that. All
right,
the blacks.
But everybody else got cold feet. Everybody else started worrying about the contracts and what was it. And they got cold feet. It's a situation that they looked around and said, oh, look who's coming. And Tommy and John were the ones left standing at the podium. And they took a tremendous stand. But it was a situation that was supposed to be, if people don't remember, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar didn't go to the Olympics as his own personal protest. And people forget that.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you guys remember an incident? I'm going back to Jesse Owens. He was asked and begged, correct me if I'm wrong, by the NAACP and the Urban Leagues and all, not to go to the Olympics to represent the United States because of his racist stand against people of color. And he says, wait a minute. This is an athletic event here. I'm not going to stop going and realizing my dream or goal or whatever the heck it is. And if he had not gone there, as much and as poor as he was after the Olympics, he would have been a nobody before the Olympics.
Yeah.
If he had
right,
and
is it
true
to that, Byron?
But he had been indoctrinated too, because he went to Ohio State, so he was already going to a school that was 95% white. So he was somewhat indoctrinated to the situation. But no, I definitely see your point on that one.
You know, it's amazing. Jim Robinson's going to be with us next week, and he talked about the situation, you know, because the Yankees have never been very pro-black any kind of way. I mean, they were the next to last team to get a black player, Elson Howard. There's no blacks of merit in the organization. They deleted great coaches as Willie Randolph and Chris Chambliss, who was the world champion batting coach, and he lost his job.
You know, how about Bob Watson wins the World Series and loses his job?
Yeah.
That's general manager. That's point one. Watson, GM, gets loses his job. Chris Chambliss loses his job. Jackson wins the World Series.
If you remember Bob Watson, he was upstairs in the, what is it, the commissioner's office or whatever. Briefcase job. No, he quit. I think he quit. He got a briefcase, but his job was his. Oh, correct me if I'm wrong again, because I remember these things, but then I could have gone left track. He was there as a disciplinarian.
We're talking about disciplinarian.
If the guy stepped out of line, he was a hammer man.
He was the one that kind of handled, if Dusty pushed the empire, if Doc Sue had three batters.
Right.
You know, he handled that. Now, the thing we're saying here is that Watson won the World Series and got fired as general manager. Chambliss won the World Series, the world batting champion, and got fired as the batting coach. Willie Randolph, you know, him and Chambliss are sitting there on the sidelines, and the Yankees don't offer him elevation. We're in the 21st century with a black president, and Yankees not even remotely thinking about a black manager. But Jim Robinson said something yesterday that the Yankees did allow, I got to look the date up, a rally to be held by A. Philip Randolph and the Porters Union that helped the civil rights. I'll have to look that up because Jim told me that I got to grab my book. But I mean, so they did. They gave him Yankee Stadium free, and Steinbrenner has always had an open policy, which is advantageous to help Grambling and Mr. late Eddie Robinson. But you know, two incidents don't make you a civil rights advocate. But Byron, getting back to you, the platform
Doctor
is yours.
Before you go back to Byron, Doc, I want to just. Before you go back to Byron, and pardon me, Byron, but Doc, I want to make this statement because I think my phone's about to cut off. It's starting to beep here, so I want to get this in case I, as I said, get
ahead,
cut off again.
Go ahead.
But I want to say this, Doc, and only because you mentioned, the thing about the presidency and whatnot. You know, the more things, as you say, change, the more they say stay the same. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I know this is a sports show, but I just have to say this in all good.
Let it flow. Let it flow.
Okay, my ideas are my own. I'm not having, you know, I'm doing my own disclaimer. But you know, seeing that you mentioned, the president of Barack Obama. You know, and I mean this, Doc, and from the heart. If this guy was anything but African-American, meaning our president, okay, he would be leading this clown, a.k.a. Willard Romney, or in this case, Willard Mitt Romney, by 30 points. He should be leading this race, this election, by 30 points. If a black man had made the gaffes and mistakes and errors in fact, that this moron that he's running against is making, he would be laughed out of the race. He should be ahead by 30 points, minimally 30 points. I've had my little editorial explosion. Thank you for the time.
Well, on that note, now I'll make my last piece before I roll out of here as well, Doc. But I just want to be able to say that if I have any opinion on that, I would basically honestly tell you that right now he probably is 13 points ahead. You got to realize we're in America.
Yeah.
They're never going to let you know that he's that much ahead because they're always going to. Now, if you look in daily news and everything, now everybody got newspaper articles about, well, Romney can still pull it off if he does this. Romney, because that's just the media. They're
that,
never
exactly.
going to tell you that this is going to be a landslide because being in America would believe it. They'd make it a landslide. They aren't going to give Barack that much of a chance. So, Brad, he's way ahead. He's probably much further ahead. But I see these polls and everything every day, and ain't nobody ever asked me what I thought. I'm like, who
exactly.
are you in the polls?
Hey, but, Byron, how could they let them change the election laws? The same, you were able to vote with the same laws and same ID that we use now. It was okay for Clinton. It was okay for Clinton. I mean, people going back to the Ford, basically, okay? I mean, it was okay for the Bush of 43, the other Bushes and everybody else. It was okay. Now, all of a sudden, there's a black man. Now, all of a sudden, we have this great, great worry about election fraud. When they have, 10 cases of it documented in the entire country, now all of a sudden, we have a solution in search of a problem.
Well, that's the way it is because you heard the commentators as soon as Barack Obama took his oath of office almost 4 years ago, there were the commentators saying, well, yeah, it's possible that he might only be a one-time president. A half hour, an hour after he took the oath of office, right away they were planning his doom. And these
hey,
are national broadcasters, anchormen.
Dusty, hold
yes.
on. This is for you and Rooney, in case any sponsors are listening. Hold just a second.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network.
This broadcasting is journalism. Let the people know what's going on.
Nah, just teasing. Real quickly, the date I wanted to give you, it was July 5th, 1930. A. Philip Randolph, the Yankees allowed him to have the stadium for a rally. And that was something Mr. Robinson, who will be with us next week, hoping to get Byron back with us next week, too. So there's some things you thought bring about. Byron, have you done any political documentaries, or you thinking about doing some?
Never.
Why not?
Come on, I like
Byron.
Sports is enough, Byron.
Come on.
Politics, I don't. You have to run that disclaimer again if you want me to really speak on politics. But I don't believe
totally
in a two-party
political
system. I don't believe in a country where you have 300 million people. Do we have only two opinions that all of us are supposed to choose from? I cannot fathom for my whole life how I can live in a country with 300 million people and we have two choices for president. I think that is the most criminal thing beyond Romney, beyond the pullout politics, beyond the election fraud, beyond this whole super PAC thing now where somebody can anonymously give somebody else $100 million. Beyond all of that,
wow.
I think it's just ridiculous and ludicrous and asinine that I live in a country with 300 million people and we only have two choices. President.
And not only that, Byron, but they said the Koch brothers are actually going to deliver on that $100 million donation. They said the Koch brothers are stopping at no end to try to get Barack Obama out. And listen, this is the most obscene and absurd thing that I've heard throughout the entire campaign, Doc, Dusty, and Byron, okay? Mitt Romney, and as you said, those Republican super PACs are going to all total spend upwards of just about $2 billion, with a B, dollars on this election re-election, this election campaign to defeat Barack Obama.
We're waiting for
the debates.
I got to run out of here shortly.
Okay.
All right.
Bye. Hey, how about Byron, just before you go, I think my sport is being my sports entertainment, I should say, is being slighted. And when are we going to do a documentary on, as I call it, the sport of kings, professional wrestling?
Oh, that's good. That's a long thought. I actually met Vince McMahon and shot some stuff for him many years ago. So I haven't really gone back into it.
That his wife Linda is trying to run for the Republican. Republican seat here in Connecticut. Linda McMahon is actually running on the Republican
Stanford,
line.
I believe it.
Have some very, very interesting stories regarding that, but I'll give it to you on another date. Let me ask you something, Byron. Well, we still have lucky enough to have you grace our airwaves. Has there ever been anybody that's been particularly difficult that you've interviewed that you've been like, a very interesting personality to, speak to. Very colorful,
I can't say as far as difficult because, I haven't really had a lot of difficulty talking with people. As far as personalities and bubbling people, I've just met a lot of people
that
are amazing. But obviously, my time spent with Muhammad Ali.
Byron, hold on. Byron, now the film we're talking about is Universal Babe Ruth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Byron?
Yes. Yes.
Where's that? Universal Babe Ruth.
Universal Babe.
Okay, got it. Hold tight.
Babe.
All right, Universal Babe. Yeah, Universal.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, fellas. Keep going.
Okay, Doc, I didn't hear you. I didn't hear Byron. I didn't hear Dust. You were telling us about Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
Of course, he's colorful guys.
Well, again, as you had mentioned earlier in the program, one of the things that I can say is that I've had the honor of actually being able to spend about 2 or 3 hours just with Muhammad and his wife Lonnie about 10 years ago. And it is true, he is very animated. And although he looks physically a certain way, his mind is still sharp as a tack. As far as writing things, that's when he trips you out. Because he keeps a pen with him and he writes a lot of stuff. And so whatever he can't articulate, if he writes it down, it'll kill you because you see that all of that energy, all that positivity, everything is still there in Muhammad. So like Lonnie told me when we got on the plane to fly together, she's like, everybody's worried about Muhammad and Muhammad ain't got nothing to worry about. Muhammad's got all the money he needs for the rest of his life. He does whatever he wants to do, and he lives his life when he wants to get up. He gets up, if he wants to train, he trains, which he still does every day. And she says if he doesn't want to train, he lives on a 400-acre farm in Michigan or something. And she's like, he goes wherever he wants to go, and he does his life exactly where he wants to live. So we feel sorry for him, but he definitely doesn't feel sorry for himself.
The thing about Ali, and you talk about Ali, you have to listen to what the man says. Service to others is a room, is the rent you pay for your room here on earth. Death is so near and time is so short for friendly acts of persuasion. And in my trust in God, sports and death, entertainment, Hall of Fame, you know, my most treasured things are his. And I remember first meeting, I have a picture of me and him coming down the street. But what I remember about Ali, it's he's the first ever winner of the Potemkin Award. And I grab a bag full of stuff. I got about 10 things in it, so I throw it in the bag. And I go over to him, and he signed like 3 or 4. And I say, thanks, champ, and I'm starting to leave. He says, well, what's in the bag? I said, champ, you can't sign all this stuff. He says, give it to me. Okay, I've said this about Ali. If Muhammad Ali has time for autographs, if Muhammad Ali has time for pictures, if Muhammad Ali has time for interviews, than every other athlete in the world in his lifetime, because Ali is the number one athlete of our generation. Jackie Robinson is right next to him, Jim Brown, but Michael Jordan, Jim Brown's up too. All these guys, Magic Johnson, Ken Griffey Jr., everybody is shooting for second place. I've been around the man. Michael Katz had one of the greatest lines of Ali I've ever seen. Ali treats the guy from the hometown newspaper the way he treats the guy from the high school, the way he treats the New York Times. And Ali always looked out for his African-American sisters and brother. I remember second Ali Frazier fight. I asked a question. He answered it. He said, are you through, bro? I said, yeah, thanks, champ. He said, okay. He said, now let me take care of my black and Hispanic brothers first, and then I'll get to you white guys. Ali always, always looked out for us. And he is the greatest champion. He's always boxing writers dinner. It's a big crowd there. He's signing autographs. For a half an hour, God comes over and says, champ, let me take you upstairs. Ali says, I'm not leaving until I sign everybody's autograph. I want Ali another night. I became close with his right-hand man. I knew he was in town. Guy says to Ali, champ, you ever thought about getting a stamped autograph? Ali said, would you want a stamped autograph? I saw an interview from Ireland, and the guy asked Ali, you know, you were exonerated, Supreme Court, do you have any ill feeling or any bad thoughts about the people who stripped you? Ali said, you know what, if I had any ill feelings towards them, I'd be as bad as them. He said, I understood where they were coming from. I just thought they would understand where I was coming from. He is a very special, unique person. And he is unquestionably the greatest. And I thank God that I've been around him. We have pictures, I have autographs, I spent time with him. We've hugged him. The greatest athlete of our generation, because it's the heart. The great line from the Bible, God said, David was a man after God's own heart. And Ali's heart, has always been serving, giving, Sometimes people understood, but Ali saved boxing. Ali made boxing. And Ali also made that religion, because Ali took the Muslim religion to heights far beyond what people could perceive. And Ali has always been simply the greatest. I mean, you can't say enough about this guy,
And I have extreme love for Muhammad. There were a couple of little things that he did that I wasn't really completely pleased about, especially after I found out the future. And mainly was his relationship with Joe Frazier, because, before Joe died, I actually spoke a lot with him. And I spoke with a lot of people around them. And I think the one only issue I had with Muhammad was that during those times when he was inactive and unable to fight, Joe fed him, man. Joe fed him and took care of that dude.
Ali never forgot that, and Ali.
But the way he attacked Joe, the gorilla, and all that stuff,
understand what you're saying. But Byron, it was about PR, and I remember the story of after he fought Joe in Manila, he called in Marvis. Marvis, he said, I heard you're upset and everything, and I want to apologize to you. He said, because it wasn't personal, Marvin. It was all about dollars and cents. But, Marvin, if you don't forgive me, then I'm not going to talk to none of the press. And Marvin said he understood and he forgave him. I remember another time when I was with the late, great Art Russ Jr., okay? Mm-hmm. And Phil Buckner had just did his book on Joe Frazier.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know. Joe never showed me that kind of disdain to it. All the time I've been around Joe, he never displayed it publicly to me. But a lady said something that was so profound. She said, you know what? As much as Joe dislikes Ali, he's always there when they have a money-making venue. He said if his dislike was that deep, that sincere, he shouldn't have showed up for those events where they both made money.
Oh, yeah, but my point is that even in talking to Joe, Joe was not mad, and Joe never had anger, but Joe, for being a strong, powerful, incredible person, was that hurt him deeply.
I think he may have gotten over it in time, but it hurt him deeply
because he was talking to me about it 2 years ago, and I'm like, dude, that happened 50 years ago, and he hurt him.
But you see, Byron, what you're saying, Joe didn't understand how he could be sitting there 1 minute laughing with joking with Ali, and Ali could switch the PR button on that quick and that fast. That was something he kind of didn't understand. I remember when they had a This Is My Life, and Joe showed up, and Ali said, I know that voice. That's Joe Frazier, you know what I mean? And he said, you know what, he told the host, he said, I can understand how you get everybody, but how did you get Joe here? And I think Joe did get over it, and what Ali said was no wise what he meant. But together, that $2.5 million was an astronomical amount of money for two guys. And I remember what Ali said when he found out what the closed circuit was going to be like. I don't know if you ever heard the line, but he told Joe, he said, Joe, we've been robbed. We should have got more money.
Mm-hmm.
We should have got more money. And I think a lot of what was said in the papers was kind of dovetailed and hyping on, too. But he no wise mean had any disdain or dislike for Joe. He respected Joe as a champion. He called Joe outside of him the greatest, and he really wouldn't have fought Joe that third time if he knew how sharp Joe still
Doc,
was.
Before Joe passed, did he realize, Doc, I mean really deeply, that those two are intrinsically linked, forever, because of their history? Did he realize that,
Just like Doc is saying, I think he truly loved Muhammad, and he truly respected. And I think the only thing that Joe had an issue with, just to clarify my own thing, was that he said it wasn't about just the way he promoted. He was like, the only thing that he had an issue with, and he wasn't just what Muhammad did to Joe, but it was with George and others. He was like, he took other black men and then Uncle Tom them and made them to be these stupid, ignorant characters. And he's like, I just wish he hadn't done that with black men in terms of how he portrayed them.
Until I die, people are going to look at Joe Louis as being this really ignorant person.
And he's like, I'm a very brilliant guy.
Well, I mean, like I said, it was about money. The thing, Joe was funny.
To a black
man, at that time in the country, during the Civil Rights era, that first fight,
Ali was the bad guy. I remember doing some interviews up in Utica, Rome, and everybody that picked Joe to win didn't pick Joe because he was the better fighter, because he was a better American. The biographer of
Thomas Hauser,
at the documentary about Joe, and I told him, you're right, people talk, where are all these people who backed Joe for Ali Frazier 1 when Joe needed some help down in Philly? I mean, I mentioned guys' name. There's enough fighters that should make sure that gym didn't close down. That gym shouldn't have closed down with the stature of some of the fighters that came out of Philly. Where was those people who backed and supported Joe all the time? And, Salda said, where are the people who were behind Joe that now that Joe needs them? And I think Joe and Ali understood. Joe didn't understand then, but that there was no disdain. There was no delay. It was about PR. It might not have been the kind of PR that we like, but the bottom line, it made dollars and cents. And you, Joe had a great line. Joe said, once you make a million, you can figure out to do something with another million. And Joe was on our show. I remember talking to Joe, and I asked Joe one time, I said, Joe, was Ollie the best fighter you ever fought? He said, yeah, he said he was. He said, but George beat me up. He's talking about George for me.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Beat me up, but you're talking, yeah, you can't talk about one without the other. Absolutely.
Yeah. Again, I take nothing away from Ali because, again, I'd already listened to him as pretty much one of the greatest people I've ever met in terms of whatever. I do have to give some stature to Arthur as well.
Mainly only
in the fact that, you know, if Arthur never picked up a tennis racket or Arthur never did what he did for USA Tennis or never even played professional tennis, I sat there and watched Arthur break down apartheid by himself and then get Nelson Mandela out of prison. And I don't think I've seen anybody do that. I think that's the greatest single accomplishment I've seen one man do. And I can't say Arthur did it all by himself, but when he went to South Africa, when Harry Edwards and everybody jumped on him about going over there and being a black man and what the hell are you doing and how you going to go play a tennis match in South Africa, that was the first step to breaking down apartheid. And then he went to jail 25 times while I knew him. He called me up in the morning. Like I told you the other day, he called me and be like, Byron, can you handle this and this and this? I'm like, wow, Arthur, where are you going? You going out of town? He's like, no, I'm going to jail today. I'm going to go to the South African embassy and I'm going to get arrested like I do every other week. I'm like, okay, cool. We just got used to it. Like every 2 weeks, we were like, okay, Arthur's going to jail. But he sacrificed a tremendous amount as well to change the nation and change the world. And he and Ali are, like I say, 1A or 1. Point A up to me for those guys.
Macro talks about Arthur. You know, Macro has really done a lot to pick up that torch that Arthur has left, and I really support him. And he talked about he got a big offer to fight in South Africa, to play Braun Borg in South Africa, and he called Arthur. He said, Arthur, you know, they offered me just some money to go down there in South Africa. He said, but if I went down there, is that going to help change anything if I go? And the author told him, no, it won't, John. And Macro said, I looked in the mirror and I took a stand. He told him, hey, if you're not going to make the adjustment and changes, you can forget about me. Borg, I have to play somebody else.
You know, I remember that, Doc, and about the time.